Side Show is now over. Go ahead, stick a golden fork in it. We're done.
Now.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Welcome to WRIF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan. Peter and Jolene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF.
That's 313-298-9743.
Now, here are Peter and Jolene.
Hey, Jolene, how you doing?
Hey, Pete, how's it going?
It's going good.
You know, I rarely call you that, but I'm feeling casual tonight.
My mom always used to call me Pete.
Very nice.
It's okay. Just, you know what they say, don't call me late for dinner.
That's right.
Excuse me. Yeah, all right. So we're here. Welcome to the broadcast. It's a phone-in talk show, 313-298-WRIF. Your turn.
And, 313-298-9743.
And call talkyes at yahoo.com. Call talkyes at yahoo.com. And that's our email. If you'd like something read on the air, short does it. If you'd like some, if you really want to give me a manifesto or something like that, I may or may not read it. But
Or you'll get back to them.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Pardon me. Okay. So, let's see. We've got a big benefit coming up for the Fifth Estate Magazine, 45-year-old paper, printed in the Motor City for most of its existence, a few years down south, but back here now. And it's if you ever want to see where, particularly me, but a lot of other people over the last 45 years, and to some extent you, Jolene, and all that, get these really strange ideas about politics and life and all that, the Fifth Estate Magazine is actually one of them, huh?
It is.
Yeah.
I have the direct source sitting right in front of me. So.
Yeah.
But I do read the Fifth Estate.
All right, every once in a while. But you can go to fifthestate.org. And now, that's such a common phrase, the Fifth Estate. There's a Canadian television show, and people routinely refer to the Fifth Estate like bloggers and what have you, because there was the first four estates. I don't even get into all this. You know, look it up. Look up Fourth Estate and look up Fifth Estate in Wikipedia. It'll tell you if you have any interest. But in any event, like most independent publications, this one particularly has no advertising, so it depends on subscribers and newsstand sales and also benefits, like it's going to occur on May Day. And one of the things that the Fifth Estate has done is to rescue a May Day, a long-standing, long-time celebration of a couple of things. One is an international working-class holiday.
Mm-hmm.
For a while, it was captured and held, captive by these authoritarian communists, like in the Soviet Union and what have you. But it's back free again, free at last. And so the working people of the world, which includes probably about 95% of us, middle class and blue-collar.
If you can get a job.
Yeah. And so we're going to be celebrating that. And it's also, it's a benefit for the magazine. So it celebrates May Day. It's also a pagan holiday of festive,
like
spring renewal.
Yes.
Seeding of all sorts and what have you. Yeah. Like that. And so, you know, the maypole and music and all that. So, and, well, let me see who's playing there. Jolene Jordan in the Dusty Picks.
We are. We're doing the first set of the night, so if you want to see us, probably 9 o'clock,
Yeah, okay. Then the D. Kroll Band, friend of mine, and Free Beer, which is also a band, not the beverage you're going to get. It's $5 to get in. That's pretty cheap these days. All the money, all the proceeds, the profits go to the support of the Fifth Estate Magazine, and it the admission fee of $5 includes a one-issue subscription to the magazine and a free copy of the magazine's 40th anniversary edition.
Nice. A little bonus there.
If you'd like more information, you can go to my website, Peter Werby, WERBE.com. Well, let's see. What else? What did I have here? Why is this in here? Oh, I know why. Because I forgot. The other thing we're celebrating, and I know some of you aren't celebrating this, is that it's the first day that smoking is being prohibited in Michigan bars.
That's right. May 1st is the day.
And if you can still hear my throat, man, I've still not cleared this up from winter. You got to know how glad I am that, you know, that this is not good. I'm not going to be spending 6 hours in a bar with tobacco being smoked. But if you're an addict, like the companies try to keep you, pardon me, that you'll be pleased to know, although many people are unpleased, that now the R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company, nation's second largest cigarette maker behind Philip Morris, is test marketing something called Camel Orbs.
What?
Yeah. It's a, let's see, it's a novel tobacco product that some critics say too closely resembles Tic Tac breath mints. And what it is, it's a smokeless product. It's in response to declining cigarette use and the rise of smoke-free air laws, including Michigan now. The study says Orbs, pellets made of finely ground tobacco with mint or cinnamon flavoring, are packed with nicotine and can poison children and lure young people to start using tobacco. The pellets dissolve in the mouth like breath mints. And let's see, the lead researcher, Gregory Connolly, a professor at the Harvard School of Public Health, said nicotine is a highly addictive drug, and to make it look like a piece of candy is recklessly playing with the health of children. I think we may have talked before, they give, and I don't know, maybe somebody knows this a little more directly. This is just a memory guess that, for instance, some of the more addictive drugs like crack and heroin have like a 40% addiction rate, and with the cigarettes, 100%.
Oh, yeah.
You smoke them, you're addicted.
It's a tough one.
Yeah, it's a tough one. Camel Orbs have been test marketed already in Portland, Oregon, Columbus, Ohio, and Indianapolis. And they've apparently had magazine articles in People, Wired, and Rolling Stone. And one ad says, enjoy anywhere, anytime, any place.
Just like a nice sunny day, you know?
Well,
or in a rainbow, maybe.
One of the things and why I can actually reconcile the state forbidding people to smoke around other people is we say suicide yes, murder no, right?
Yeah.
So if you want to kill yourself, even though it's being, you know, your death is being manipulated by a big corporation and, you know, levels of nicotine being fixed and all that. And
yeah, higher. Well, they're higher than ever, right?
Yeah. Still, I don't want you to take me with you. It's like you're going to decide to immolate yourself, and after you've struck the match, you're going to want to give me a big goodbye hug.
Yeah, well, everyone will get used to it eventually. I know it's going to be tough for a lot of people who spend a lot of time in the bars, and drinking and smoking go together. I mean, you know.
Yeah. But this, with these orbs, I guess it's just suicide. I don't know. Maybe it's not going into your lungs.
Right.
I wonder if it is.
It's in your blood system. Right?
Yeah. No, I wonder if it would create cancer.
I don't know.
It sounds terrible, though.
I know. It really does. I'd rather just have a Tic Tac.
Yeah, that's better. Yeah, one makes your breath smell really nice, and the other one makes it smell really bad.
Yeah.
Dr. Jonathan P. Winnikoff, who's a Harvard medical professor, and let's see, he says the difference here is that kids potentially will be watching grown-ups ingesting these products. What does this mean? The last time, I'd have to really explain this quote. Never mind. He said, he contended that the tobacco industry was creating novel products partly to entice and addict a new generation of smokers to replace those who die. Because, you know, 400,000 of their best customers die every single year. So, yeah, the replacement deal is tough. So there won't be, I doubt if there'll be very many of those on May 1st, the benefit for the Fifth Estate. Oh, we didn't even say where, at the New Way Bar.
Oh, my gosh, who just celebrated their 75th anniversary this weekend. They had a big weekend there. I didn't make it over. I wanted to, but.
You? You missed it?
I did, yeah. I had a benefit I was performing at, so, last night.
Okay, so it's at, actually the address probably won't do you any good, but it's on Woodward.
Between 9 and...
Half a mile north.
Between 9 and 10.
Yeah, and it's on the east side of the street.
Yeah, look for the red awning.
Yeah, be
next
there.
Next to the Subaru dealership. I know, I've been there many times.
Be there or be square.
Yeah.
You know, I usually don't talk too much about President Obama. I mean, I really don't. I mean, usually if I am, where the people are making nutty charges about him.
Yes.
But he was really in the news. He took part in this commemoration of the 29 miners who died, and just about everybody was there. The vice president. I mean, I can't believe that they let the head of Massey Energy, the one, you know, the guy that ran the firm with all the violations. But it gives you an idea of what has to be done, the kind of sacrifice, in order to maintain fossil fuel dependence. And then when coal is burned, I mean, it's horrid.
Yes.
Absolutely horrid.
It's dirty.
And out in the Gulf of Mexico, after that explosion and the sinking of that oil well, now there's 42,000 gallons a day of oil polluting the Gulf of Mexico as it leaks into it from the wrecked drilling platform.
Yeah, even if it was Earth Day, it was a bad week for Mother Earth.
So why in the world would there be any effort to maintain fossil fuels?
Oh, wait, let me guess. Money.
Yeah, exactly. Well, couldn't these people, you know, the thing is that ExxonMobil, maybe actually they've gotten into it. Like ExxonMobil, if it was an energy company rather than an oil company,
mm-hmm.
you know, you'd just make the switch. Just like if the train companies, for instance, would have been transportation companies, mm-hmm. they could have made automobiles and planes and stuff like that. But they, you know, they were a little too focused.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, anyway. Let's see. Obama also. Did you see this?
I did. I know what you're going to talk about.
Yeah. What's that?
Billy Graham.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's up with this? And someone, a friend of mine, posted this story about President Obama making a pilgrimage. Do you like that? Sunday to Billy Graham's mountainside home. And my friend said, this is the first sitting president to ever visit this guy's house. Now, why is he doing it?
I don't know. I don't get it. Do you really think, I mean, talk about hypocrisy. Does Barack Obama strike you as a very religious man? Well, of course, neither did George Bush, who was always talking about the Lord. I mean, why do these guys got to fake it?
Bush really never convinced me. Obama's a little more convincing.
Well, he doesn't even have a church in Washington. No, he goes to one once in a while, but he's still looking for one.
Oh, is that what it is?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I can't.
Well, that's because he's a Muslim, right?
Yeah.
I mean, come on.
He's looking for a Christian church.
Yeah.
It's the wrong guy. Don't tell him. But look, folks, we got to tell a lot of people, we are kidding.
Yeah, we are absolutely kidding. We're making fun of the people who absolutely stand by their thoughts and feelings that he is a Muslim.
Yeah. But, you know, I guess I don't ever believe that these people that are really enmeshed in power structures as their key personal definition, as well as their professional and bureaucratic definition, are really deeply religious.
Yeah.
It's just for the rubes.
Well, he had to. He has no matter what. Even if he is or not, he has to keep up that.
Well, the 48-year-old president made the short drive to Montreat from Asheville, where he spent the weekend to see the 91-year-old Graham and his son, Franklin Graham.
I mean, this is so disturbing to me.
It is. During the visit, which lasted about 30 minutes and included aides and advisors to both men, Obama had a private prayer and conversation with Billy Graham.
Evangelist.
The evangelist, thank you. The evangelist.
It took two of us tonight to say that.
Gave Obama two Bibles, one for him and one for the First Lady. And let's see. Okay. Here, though, Franklin. Oh, wait a minute. I'm missing one part of it here.
Obama was extraordinarily gratified that he took the time to meet with him. Really?
Oh, yeah. Franklin Graham said his father prayed for the nation and that God would give Obama wisdom in his decision. The president prayed to thank God for Billy Graham's life.
You cannot petition the Lord with prayer!
Thank you.
Thank you. Jim Morrison, thank you very much. This seems so inappropriate. Does anybody else agree or disagree?
Are we the only offended ones?
Yeah. Yeah.
I wonder.
Franklin Graham has been in the news recently with the Army, who rescinded an invitation for him to speak at a Pentagon prayer service, which seems absolutely inappropriate, that has just riffed with these far right-wing evangelical Christians talking about how these wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are these religious crusades, which, of course, drives the upper brass crazy, because that's what they're trying to tell the people in those countries. It's not. We're just trying to help you. It doesn't have anything to do with oil. You know, we want you to be free, right? Even though we're destroying your countries. Let's see. They took back the invitation. The Pentagon canceled it. Franklin Graham said he and Obama spoke briefly about the Pentagon spat, with the younger Graham saying that activists with an agenda were trying to pull all religion out of the military. No, they're not. They just don't want you because you said that you found Islam offensive and that you want Muslims to know that Jesus Christ died for their sins and that you think that Islam is evil.
What, this guy has a lot of nerve. Yeah. A lot of noise. I mean, really. Whack jobs.
I mean, there's...
And Obama. What's that that you always tell me if you see two people sitting on the corner, you can't tell, you know, a guy sitting next
this
to a
this sounds like
a
George Bush... never mind.
I'm you can't tell who the fool is.
Yeah. Now, Billy Graham, he's got a nice history as well. You may remember that, let me see if I got the whole thing. Yeah, in a taped 1972 conversation, Billy Graham, that religious man who's close to God, who counsels presidents, who speaks for the Lord, he was talking with Richard Nixon in the Oval Office, unbeknownst to him, that it was all being taped.
Oh, yeah.
Which I never understood how in the world Tricky Dick Nixon would say the things he did knowing he was taping himself.
Pretty bad move, pretty dumb.
So here's what Billy Graham said, that the Jewish stranglehold on the media has got to be broken or this country's going down the drain. Nixon replies, "You believe that?" "Yes, sir." And Nixon says, "Oh, boy, so do I. I can't ever say that, but I believe it," says Nixon. And Graham replies, "If you get elected a second time, then we might be able to do something."
Oh, my gosh.
I don't know what. What do you do? What do you do when the Jews are giving you problems? You know, you round them up. I mean, when this came out, he said, "These do not reflect my views, and I sincerely apologize for any offense caused by the remarks." Yeah, you got caught.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. You're sorry you got caught.
Yeah. Let's see. But later in the conversation, when Nixon raises the subject of Jewish influence in Hollywood, and remember, this is Nixon knowing he's taping himself.
Maybe he just forgot for a minute.
Here's what Billy Graham says. "A lot of Jews are great friends of mine. They swarm around me and are friendly to me because they know that I am friendly to Israel and so forth, but they don't know how I really feel about what they're doing to this country, and I have no power and no way to handle them." Now, do you think that really did not reflect his views? Of course. I mean, how could anybody say something that insanely anti-Semitic and not really reflect his views? Nixon, who became friends with Mr. Graham in the 1950s during his time as vice president, advised Reverend Graham, "You must not let them know."
Can you believe this?
These are some evil MFs.
Yeah, and this just came out within the last year or so, right?
Yeah. So there were the tapes. Let me see, when did it come? He says, Graham said, here's what he said, "Although I have no memory of the occasion, I deeply regret comments I apparently made in the Oval Office in conversation with President Nixon some 30 years ago."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In a statement released by his Texas public relations firm.
Yeah. Obama could have chosen a lot of people to visit.
Yeah.
But he chose this guy. And I think it's because of that whole meeting that he was not allowed to go to.
First Amendment to the Constitution says Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. So fearful, I feel bad about having to say this so often, but so fearful were the founding fathers of the intertwining of religion and politics, because they'd seen it all in Europe, and they knew what happened. Remember, they came from Christian countries where you could get prosecuted, you could get branded, you could get whipped for blasphemy. And people say, "Look what they do in Iran," and that's what they used to do in our country. They're just a few hundred years behind.
Right.
They behead people. Well, that's what they used to do.
Right.
You know, they don't burn them at the stake the way they did Savon. What was his name?
They disemboweled people.
Yeah. Or they drew and quartered them. So, Well, you say, "Well, we don't do that anymore." No, we do it from airplanes.
Right.
Yeah. They're a little, on the ground. So they're a few hundred years behind. But, that's religion. I mean, again, we know good religious people, and there's good religious people doing good things in the world. But in the main, religion has been sort of a bloody sword throughout history.
No question.
Yeah. all of them. So I'm not picking on Christianity. Our pal, Annie Laurie Gaylor, clicked through a flurry of email messages warning her to repent or she would burn in hell.
And she just giggled, I'm sure.
Yeah, she said. And, you know, this is one of the things they're all about, cosmic blackmail.
You know, and we know what we're talking about, but everyone else is probably like, who is this and
Ms.
what
Gaylor
did she do?
Leaned back and sipped from a cup of tea, unfazed and even a bit surprised at the relative tameness of the attack. Fresh from her latest godless triumph, she had expected more vitriol. It used to be a lot worse, she said, an atheist whose organization, the Freedom From Religion Foundation, recently won a suit in federal court that declared the National Day of Prayer to be a violation of the First Amendment.
She did.
Can we go back? Where was that little statement? You know, Congress shall make no law. I mean, why isn't that slam dunk?
Yeah, I would think.
Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion. And President Harry S. Truman in 1952 signed a bill saying that there shall be a national day of prayer. And the whole thing is run by this Christian prayer group. So that would seem to blow it all off, wouldn't it?
I would think so.
I mean, if people want to pray, why don't all these churches get together? Why do they have to have the government
exactly
give it its impromptu, if you will?
Yes.
Whoa.
Ooh.
So, in fact, it gains nothing, and it risks a lot. Here's why I say it. I mean, because National Day of Prayer. Does anybody think that anything really happens? I mean, even if you're religious, that God sees that this country, with all of its sins, has on that day done what? I don't even get it. You know, you pray for what?
For what?
You know, God bless America. You know.
All right. You're done.
And, you know, he's up there, she's up there saying, yeah, I'll give it some consideration. Right?
Yeah.
So I don't get it. On the other hand, the history of the commingling of government and religion, as I always say, one nation under God, which is Iran, is the best example.
Yeah, for sure.
Or you go back into our European history, you see all of that, you know, in Spain and Inquisition, religious wars, all that. That's bad. Let's see. The nation's population continues to show signs of becoming less religious, according to the American Religious Identification Survey. The number of people in 2008 calling themselves atheist or agnostic or stating no religious preference is an estimated 15%, which has doubled in the last few years or so. I would say, I mean, that a lot, you tell me, you can call 313-298-WRIF. You haven't been to church in 18 years, and someone says to you, what religion are you? And you say, oh, I'm Protestant. Or
Methodist.
You haven't given confession since you were 11 years old, and someone says to you, what religion are you? And you say, Catholic. I mean, so I think that the irreligious population is probably about 40% or something like that.
Much larger than this says right here.
Yeah. The Freedom From Religion Foundation claims a membership of more than 14,000, of which I am a proud member. Over the years, the group has won a suit to stop Bible instruction in a Tennessee school district, overturned a Madison law ordering businesses to close for hours on Good Friday, and stopped a Colorado public school from requiring students to do volunteer work at churches. But their big win is just recently when Judge Barbara B. Crabb of the Federal District Court ruled that the federal government could not enact a law in support of prayer any more than it could, quote, encourage citizens to fast during the month of Ramadan, attend a synagogue, purify themselves in a sweat lodge, or practice rune magic. Well, I'd be for that.
Yeah, me too.
I mean, the pagan thing.
Yeah.
No, you can't do it. You can't do it. So we have a National Day of Prayer. Why don't we have all these other religions get a shot, and including our pals, our pagan pals as well? I don't get it. In the meantime, since the government has 60 days to appeal, the Obama administration will defend the prayer day in court that the White House signed this year's prayer proclamation. What do you mean? What as in?
Signed the. I don't get what you're saying.
Establishing. Establishing May 6th as a National Day of Prayer.
So
even though it was declared unconstitutional.
Oh my gosh.
You cannot petition the Lord with prayer.
Thank you, Jim.
Yeah. That, by the way, is Calvinism, which decided that the elect that were known in advance, those that would go to heaven, and the rest of us would be downstairs.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that's why we have that organization. What about the pets, though, remember?
Oh, yeah.
What about the animals? I mean, fortunately, there's that business now that if you do believe in the, what do they call it?
The rapture.
Thank you. If you believe in the rapture, what, you know, what's happening with your dog? So in the next 10 years, you can spend $100 and pay this organization. If the rapture happens within 10 years, they will take care. I mean, they take horses and ferrets and birds and monkeys and whatever. I mean, that's a pretty cheap deal. If I believed in the rapture and I have a lot of animals, I would be paying.
You got to go online and check this out. I'm not sure what you'd look there. Just put in rapture animal insurance.
Yeah.
I think you would get that.
You'll find it.
Now, let me see. Do we have any time? Yeah. If you're waiting online, hold on. We'll get to you. 313-298-WRIF. Now, this because of, you know, you realize how long it's been, and we're, let's not mention either the politician whose name begins with a P or that frenzied crowd that revolves around her, okay?
Okay.
But it seems like they've spent their load. You know they've kind of all of it, they peaked the ferocity.
You feel like they're fizzling out?
Yeah, well, yeah. It was sort of like, actually, I don't know. Is that so totally incorrect? Politically incorrect. I don't think I. But in this story that you really can't read anymore, this African kid has this tiger chase him around a tree and just turns into butter.
Oh, yeah. There used to be restaurants named after.
Yeah, yeah. It turns into just butter. So, I mean, they just had nowhere to go. They peaked way too early. And since they're only about 18% of the population, they don't
peak
for too much. Yeah. But there's still this thought, as so frequently happens, after one party wins the presidency in the what they call the off-year election, the party out of power makes big gains in Congress.
Yes.
To the point now where, you know, the legend, so to speak, is that Obama is so dramatically disliked that the Democrats are going to suffer great losses. But actually, if they, there's, you know, very probable there's going to be losses. And it's going to be that there was, what was it? I think it was, we were going, whoa, so many people are voting. Like 60% of people voted, mm-hmm. which is considered a disaster in most democracies, but it was more than it had voted in a long time.
Usually it's in the 30th percentile, right?
And that's what it'll be on the off election, which Republicans tend to vote in greater numbers. But also there's been a lot of disillusionment with Barack Obama. I mean, a lot of people thought he was going to really make dramatic changes. And some of the changes have come about, like the medical reform bill and what have you. A lot of stuff just looks like a continuation of Bush with the wars and what have you. So, the idea was, all right, these Democrats aren't working too well. I got a great idea. Let's get the Republicans in.
Right.
That doesn't really seem like the brightest idea in the world. In fact,
it's not the solution you're looking for.
I wish there was a way, since things are really not going real well, that Obama could say, you know what, McCain and the woman who won the silver medal in the last election, right, for vice president, we're going to give you the government. All right, you know, you're going to be the president, the vice president, give the Congress to the Republicans and say, yeah, go for it, dudes. You know?
At it.
Yeah. And Boner, what's his first name?
John.
John Boner from Ohio. He could be the head of the House instead of Nancy Pelosi.
They could bring back Joe the Plumber.
Yeah. And what's which one of the whack jobs in the Senate would be the head of the Senate?
Boy.
Give it all to him. Let him, go for it. Because you guys must have a lot of great ideas because, you know, you're so critical of Obama.
Bring it.
Yeah. But I just got something that said... the national debt is a percentage of gross domestic product, which is all pretty, complicated.
It is.
You just yawned.
I'm sorry, Peter. You're not boring me. It was a long weekend.
Right. The last three Republican presidents, ready for this? You know, they're talking about the national debt. There a lot of people are so furious about that.
Sure.
The last three Republican presidents, which is Reagan, Bush, right?
Reagan, Bush.
Yeah, yes.
Reagan, Bush.
Yeah.
Okay.
Have accounted for nearly 100% of our increase in the debt. How about that?
Well. And, it's a little factoid.
And this from the Democrat. This is actually, we haven't checked them out too much lately. DemocraticUnderground.com says, why do Republican economic principles expand the national debt? The answer is simple mathematics. Reduced revenue plus increased spending equals increased debt.
Yeah.
So you're going to fight a bunch of wars that aren't needed.
Right.
And you reduce.
But we knew all this was going to happen, Peter.
Yes. And you reduce the taxes on the. On the rich.
For 8 years, yeah. We went on and on and on about how bad it was going to be. Who was? Why weren't these Republicans listening to us then?
All right, let's do this. Whoa, none of our information is coming across our little screen.
Elusive.
But we have you on hold.
We know you're there. We'll take your call.
1, 2, and 3, and we'll be right back after these. Read after these, after these, after these. Okay. How about after these?
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Jalene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
It all starts with having a good pre-screened group of contractors to choose from. And Hire It Done is your one-stop guide to finding the one that's right for your home improvement project. Hi, I'm Adam Helfman, host of WRIF's Hire It Done. Before you start your day's home improvement tasks around your house, grab a cup of hot coffee and tune us in Saturday mornings from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. Join us this weekend. We'll learn why spring is the best time to redo your roof. And if you have a tax refund on the way, we'll help you make it work for you again with the top 10 home improvement projects that will save you money over and over and over again. Arnie Goodman of American Standard Roofing is back and sits down with us on the Contractor's Corner to answer all of your roofing questions. Hire It Done's money-saving tip of the week, our Green Minute. We'll head back to school at Hire It Done University, and we're going to teach you how to avoid getting scammed. Plus, I'll take your house calls live. All this Saturday, beginning at 7 a.m. on Hire It Done and 101 WRIF, The Riff.
Hire It Done!
Giving mom a new wireless phone on Mother's Day is smart. Giving mom a new wireless phone from Verizon on Mother's Day? That, my friends, is smarter. Seriously, from sunrise to sweet dreams, she runs the family. Doesn't she deserve the best network? I thought so. The truth is, when you want your network to work, you want Verizon. And now, choose from great phones under $30, like the new feature-rich BlackBerry Curve. Buy one for only $29.99 after $100 mail-in rebate debit card. And get one free. Or the Samsung Intensity. It's a total messaging machine, and it's free after a $50 mail-in rebate debit card. That's right, free. You're smart. Now get smarter and give mom the network that really works. Visit Verizon Wireless, verizonwireless.com, or call 1-800 to join in. All phones require new 2-year activation. BlackBerry requires a voice plan with data pack $29.99 or higher. Early termination and not fees apply. Coverage details at verizonwireless.com.
Did you know the tap water in your home may be hazardous? Not to your health, but to your appliances and your wallet. Your home's hard water creates pipe clogging line scale, and that can shorten the life of your water heater, ruin your dishwasher, and break down your washing machine. Lime scale deposits block the heating element, and that could be costing you an extra $1,200 a year in energy and wear. But you can remove lime scale without chemicals, magnets, or salts. It's easy with HydraCare, the patented device used worldwide. See for yourself at bestsoftwater.com. You simply clip HydraCare to your main water pipe. HydraCare removes and prevents limescale buildup in your entire plumbing system. If your home has hard water, extend the life of your appliances with HydraCare. Try it risk-free. Just go to bestsoftwater.com. That's bestsoftwater.com. Or call now 888-883-8187. That's 888-883-8187.
Detroit's Rock Station, 101 WRIF.
The Riff.
This is your Car Care Minute. With more folks taking driving vacations this year, the pros at the National Institute for Automotive Service Excellence offer the following tips to help you arrive at your destination safely. First, review your owner's manual and follow the recommended service schedules. Be certain to check the level and concentration of the cooling system. Check your tires for wear and pressure. And be sure your heating and air conditioning systems are operating efficiently. If you've been experiencing performance problems such as hard starts, rough idling, or stalling, now's the time to have your vehicle serviced by a certified automotive technician. It's extra insurance against an annoying breakdown while on vacation. Your Car Care Minute is a public service by this station and the National Institute for Automotive Service Excellence, ASE.com.
Detroit's Rock Station, 101, The Real Rift.
Do you owe back taxes to the IRS that you can't afford to pay? Or are you stuck in a tax payment plan that's getting you nowhere? The IRS is now taking very aggressive actions, such as bank levies and wage garnishments. If you owe the IRS at least $15,000, call American Tax Relief. They've helped thousands of people like you eliminate up to 85% of their delinquent taxes. Call 1-800-493-8159. If you qualify, American Tax Relief can settle your tax debt for less than you owe, remove penalties and interest, and protect you from bank levies and garnishments. As a hardworking American, you do have rights. Call American Tax Relief for a free consultation and see how much money they can save you. Call 1-800-493-8159. If you qualify, you can save up to 85% on the taxes you owe. Call right now. 1-800-493-8159. That's 1-800-493-8159.
Defender, you've got to help us. Mole Man has fired his darkening missile towards the sun. It'll put the world in shadow.
Don't worry. Too late to catch the missile. I'll just fly quickly around the Earth in reverse time.
The Red Defender begins to circle the Earth faster and faster until his momentum literally changes Earth's rotation on its axis.
I'm back, citizens. No need to thank me. Strange. It's dark in the middle of the afternoon. And where is everyone? You, old man, with a flashlight.
I was young just a minute ago.
I must have gone the wrong way and sped up time. Whoops. Sorry about that.
Saving the world isn't easy. Saving a life is. Just one pint of blood can save up to 3 lives. To find out more, go to bloodsaves.com. A public service message brought to you by the Ad Council.
Yes. This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Julene Jordan.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome back to our second segment. Remember, Saturday, May 1st, coming up, benefit for the Fifth Estate Magazine featuring the Julene Jordan Band, the Dusty Picks, a couple other bands, going to be in Ferndale at the New Way Bar, start about 9 p.m., and go to my website, Peter Werby, WERBE.com. One of the things we're talking about is going to be also a celebration of all the May Day. In fact, I found that really interesting, the Wikipedia entry for May Day.
Yeah?
Yeah. So if you're interested, check that out. But also, first smoke-free night of the new
yeah.
law. And I was commenting that R.J. Reynolds is putting out something called Camel Orbs, which is this little dissolvable tobacco product that you put in your mouth. And we had a comment, I believe, on that. We're having a little problem with our... what would you call this?
Our connection
computer thing.
To
yeah.
the phone screeners, so we see what your names are and everything like
there
that.
You go. But if everything is going right, this is Leah from Port Huron. Leah, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Good, it's you. Good, it worked. What's
I've
up?
I've had a very, very, very bad week. My Earth Day really sucked, and it was supposed to be a good day.
Oh, no, what happened?
I really can't get into it.
Okay.
I went to a 420 party, and it was with a lot of rockin'-ass bands, but
yeah.
I really had a bad... You don't need to know my drama.
Yeah, okay, well, we thought it was something
question,
to do with, like, the Earth.
The question was about the camel. Was that camel stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What is it, actually, again?
It's ground
sort of
up,
heard, but sort of did not.
It's ground up nicotine, finely
tobacco,
ground
tobacco.
Yeah, tobacco, and then it's in like it's like a little Tic Tac.
Yeah, and it looks, it tastes...
It dissolves in your mouth.
And it's
so it's not anything to do with like that snuff chips or snuff
no.
stuff that they had?
No, no they no. had those little pocket.
Because that was disgusting. I mean, I kept a little tin, but the stuff inside, no.
Oh, did you get it free, like, downtown?
Yes, we had a concert. We were at the Candlebox concert. We got free smokes and free snuffs, and I got, like, every night we went to a concert.
I mean, there's a guy. There's a
I
few
guys. I took my kid to the first Kiss concert. It was the Kiss Cheerleading Band, but that was my 7-year-old's first concert.
Well, I can
wow.
imagine there's guys out there. In fact, there's still guys out there that chaw, you know. I mean,
sure.
Yeah.
I'm sure.
I mean, there used to be a DJ here that actually had this little cup.
Really?
Yeah. And used to, you know, little, because they don't have spittoons anymore, right?
I used to, well, you know, I have a couple of marriages
Leah,
under my belt.
Thanks for your call.
First husband used to chew that stuff. And I would
no
just,
way.
He did. But listen, he was so hot that it didn't matter. But then after a while, it mattered. First, yeah, I'm like, you can chew anything you want.
Wow. Got some open lines for you. 313-298-WRIF. Here's TJ in Westland. Hey, TJ, you're on the air.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
That smoke stuff, I had a chance to try some. It tastes like shit.
Oh, man. You can't talk like that, though.
Oh, we can't cuss on the fucking air?
Oh. Dude, this is a idiot. You know.
Did you hit it again?
Yes, we
okay.
did. But, you know, TJ, we have your number, you know, and this is a federal offense. Do you understand that? So we're going to turn it over to our security tomorrow, and they'll make a decision what to do with it. I hope they throw your ass in jail, dummy.
Oh my gosh.
I don't know why I even bothered to...
After the first offense.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, I wanted to...
See you later, TJ. I did get an email from William who says, if Obama or any other political figure wants to pray, go do it in a church, but keep it out of my life. Then Obama expands the faith-based bull hockey instead of getting rid of it. And, the National Day of Prayer.
Here's what I wanted for him, too.
That was, there you go, Peter. That was pretty good turnaround.
Yeah. All right. Here's Ron and Warren. Ron, hi. You're on the air.
How you doing, Pete? How you doing?
Good.
Oh, great. Thanks. How are you?
Hey, I just wanted to make one comment on religion. And I know, you know, you guys are probably somewhat against it to a certain degree. But, you know, it saved so many people's lives. It's corrected so many misguided people throughout the years. I mean, people that were addicted to drugs, alcohol, tobacco.
I do know. I do know a few people where I believe that their finding religion was a good thing. I really do.
We know a friend. His Facebook page used to be addicted to drugs and booze. Now he's addicted to religion.
That's right.
That works.
But our whole problem is church and state. It's the government and religion melding together.
Ron, did you hear that? Did you hear what Jalene just said?
Sorry, I didn't. I'm sorry.
Okay, our problem with religion is about the separation of church and state and how it's not so separated anymore, and that's what we're bitching about.
Right. I mean, but Obama has, he lives in the White House. He's in the public eye all the time. I mean, he one day a week, I mean, he deserves to have some religion in his life.
I don't know if he deserves it, but do you think it's sincere or just political?
I mean, he is human.
I know, but do you think it's sincere or just political?
I think it's sincere to a certain degree. And
I'm glad no one described me as sincere to a certain point.
You know, but I wonder, what about this Billy Graham? You know, but why should he go visit Billy Graham?
Well, Billy Graham's human, too. He's not perfect. I mean, you know, I'm not saying he's...
Yeah, you're right, a little anti-Semitic.
Kind of he's kind of an anti-Semitic human, but, you know, hey.
But he apologized.
Yeah, he did.
All right, Ron, thank you very much. Appreciate all of that. Listen, there again, we have to say each time there are so many people that have done so many good things in the name of religion, but I often say, and I feel badly sometimes because I know some of them are listening, that many of these people are a footnote of a footnote, because when you think of the bloody history of religion. And I'm not just talking about Christianity. I mean, read the Old Testament. Oh, my Lord. Oh, my Lord. Who orders like this genocide, you know, wipe these people out, sell them into slavery. But you go back, I mean, the first thing that religion did, I mean, religion, when the political state arose, depending on when you really want to identify it as such, 4,000 years ago or more. It arose in tandem with the authoritarian political state because it had to identify this pyramidal society, this hierarchy, as being heavenly ordained, because previously people had lived in egalitarian societies, or, you know, pretty much so. And suddenly, when classes also arose, I don't mean reading and writing and arithmetic,
right,
but social classes. You had a ruling class. You had this little teeny ruling elite that said they were ordained by gods or goddesses or who, not usually not goddesses. You know, the goddess thing, that's a whole other deal. They were a little cooler.
The goddess thing's kind of really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the gods, sky gods, which were always male, so always patriarchal, always hierarchical.
Weren't they really always really muscly, too? Kind of buff?
I don't know. Here is Brian in Huntington Woods. Brian, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, first-time caller, long-time listener.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Yeah, thanks. I said Huntington Woods, but I should really say more like Ypsilanti, because I really lived there more over the last 12 years than I have here.
Let's talk about that for a while.
Why did you move?
Never mind.
No. Job change.
Brian, we're only joking. Give us the subject. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. The religion thing growing up, parents had us going to Unitarian church kind of when we wanted to. That was sort of, as you might know, you know, whatever you want to do, believe, say, that's cool with them.
That's pretty groovy.
You know, I don't go to church or any of that stuff. And I, you know, just growing up in the neighborhood, we were probably the only family on the block who weren't going home and our parents telling us that there was God and you have to go out and tell everybody in school and all your classmates about God and going to church and all that stuff. And these families, thinking back, I've talked to my sister about this, they're kind of a mess. And we seem to really have our act together, so whatever that's worth.
Well, I would say that probably that religiosity and a good moral person, an ethical person who's a good member of the community, a good parent, a good neighbor, and all that, probably has nothing to do with religion. In other words, all the good religious people I know if you took away their religion, they'd still be good people. I mean, remember at the end of The Godfather when his son is being baptized and his men are just killing everybody?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, think about this. I mean, some of these criminal, families, they're very religious, and they were always very supportive of the church. And I mean, that was part of Coppola's contention in The Godfather.
Right.
So I don't think that there's a great... if the standard was the Ten Commandments, I don't know that those folks that said that they were great adherents of the faith adhered to them to any larger extent than atheists, say.
Right. And, you know, God has such an influence on people in this world that I was reading a book on Michelangelo back in the late 1400s, early 1500s. You know, Italy was divided in all these cantons and things, and Michelangelo's family had some land up in the Bologna area, I believe. Bologna had its own, like, ruler, whatever. Well, they were telling the Vatican, we're not paying you any more money, we're our own thing. So the Pope gets his Swiss guards and a crew and himself, and they're headed up there to, like, kick everybody's butt up in Bologna. I mean, so,
sure.
You know, it was about wealth and money.
Well, yeah, that's
what power.
I mean, think about the Crusades. That was all about. I mean, there were people that were overcome just with religious insanity. Really, the Crusades were all about trade routes, control of the Middle East, just like it is now. That's why when Bush, remember at the beginning, said that the war in Iraq was a crusade, they go no, and that's what Al Qaeda calls us. You know, the Jews and the Crusaders, you know, we're the Crusaders. So it's always been about the money. That's for sure. That's for sure.
You know what I really got out of
Brian's
phone call is that he didn't have religion shoved down his throat and they could go and kind of go when they want. And I'll tell you, I currently have a family member who has a daughter who, and she is just shoving it down this daughter's throat. And it's really hard to hear about.
Well, one of the things,
she's rebelling.
I think it was like in 1964. Yeah, it was, or somewhere right around in there. The Supreme Court held that daily prayers in school was unconstitutional. It represented an establishment of religion, and then so all these right wingers are saying, see, and then the country went to hell. Look at the 1960s, was riots and strikes and smoking marijuana and
right.
sex and all of that. Except the thing that they missed is that everybody that came of age in the 60s went to school where they said prayers every day.
Right?
Right?
Yes, it's a good point.
Yeah, didn't do anything. That had no effect whatsoever. Yeah. They were the... never mind. Sometimes I'm going to say things, and I think, you know, I sort
sometimes
of...
Sometimes you do stop yourself.
Well, I do because I realize that, that you know, we're pretty intense in what we're saying. But everyone...
And we're used to it.
And everyone isn't listening quite as intently as we're talking. And it occurred to me, I mean, I've made a joke about some of the things I've said in the past. What I said is a joke, and people say, you're such a hypocrite, and I'm thinking, I write back to them, I said, you know, I was joking. And then it occurs to me, they didn't get it.
Yeah, they didn't get the joke.
Yeah. Well, here's not a joke. As you may know, that the United States is the United States Armed Forces in Afghanistan are gearing up for an attack on Kandahar, which is southern Afghanistan's largest city.
Right.
So it's a huge metropolitan area. And the world's most powerful war machine is cranking up its personnel and machinery to do anything, to level this place. If you think back to... Iraq and that city of what was it? Where all
what,
of a sudden,
Baghdad?
Fallujah. No, oh. Fallujah. That just, you know, one of those things where we had to destroy the city in order.
It was real bad there.
Yeah, it was real bad. 95% of the population of Kandahar does not want an attack on.
On their city.
Yeah, on their city.
And I don't blame them.
And they want negotiations mm-hmm. with the Taliban.
Right.
But the United States has been sent over there under what? I mean, where did the okay for this come?
Yeah, with George Bush.
Yeah. Well, small bands of elite American Special Operations Forces have been operating with increased intensity for several weeks in Kandahar, picking up or picking off insurgent leaders to weaken the Taliban in advance of major operations. The looming battle for the spiritual home of the Taliban is shaping up as a pivotal test of President Obama's Afghanistan strategy. It will follow a first offensive into the hamlet of Marja that is showing mixed results, and it will require the United States and its Afghan partners to navigate a battleground that is not only much bigger than Marja, but also militarily, politically, and culturally more complex. 2 months after the Marja offensive, Afghan officials acknowledge that the Taliban have in some ways retaken the momentum there. So all the destruction, all the loss of life, and,
for what?
Yeah.
Right back where they were.
There was a long article, and I often read this, and you can't really do it. But this is it's called Feeling Warehoused in Army Trauma Care Units. A year ago, Specialist Michael Crawford wanted nothing more than to go into Fort Carson's Warrior Transition Battalion, a special unit created to provide closely managed care for soldiers with physical wounds and severe psychological trauma. Now, we have men and women that have been in these theaters of combat over and over and over again. When you have, particularly when you're, they always used to call it during World War I, shell-shocked. But, there certainly was horrific sights in there. But, you know, here, frequently when you're fighting a civilian population and you, like it's happened so many times, particularly in Afghanistan, but it happened a lot in Iraq, is that... you don't have time to perhaps make the considered decisions that you would like to.
That's right.
And you wind up just wiping out a civilian wedding party.
Yeah,
or
right.
Just happened a couple months ago, killing pregnant women and all of that. Or seeing your, looking over and there's your buddy without his legs.
Well,
and what have you.
There's no way that you can be fully okay after that. I saw, in fact, a moving poetry piece last night about from a friend of mine who was over in Iraq, and the whole piece was about finding this little 6-year-old boy blown to bits. Yeah. And is your mic on, Peter?
Well, it will. It works better if I sit closer to it.
And so, but, you know, I saw firsthand the pain through poetry, you know, which was really amazing. It was tough. It was tough to hear and tough to watch. I can only imagine being there.
And Obama is throwing, you know, more men and women into the Bush war. And it's not even clear. I mean, the Taliban, given that here's a good example of One Nation Under God as well. The Taliban were that want to completely intertwine government and their religious precepts.
Yeah.
So they're a pretty distasteful bunch. And what they did during their rule was pretty horrific. Of course, it was blowback from...
They destroyed all those beautiful big Buddhas. Remember that?
Yeah. Yeah. Ugh. Hey. Remember, it's all everything is impermanent.
That's right. It's okay.
It's okay. Yeah. Actually, it was pretty horrible.
It was.
But the fact that the Taliban are in there, the fact that there's Osama bin Laden, is a whole part of the blowback of American policy in Afghanistan to begin with, where the United States financed these far right wing Muslim mujahideen, and hey, we got Osama bin Laden, we got the Taliban out of it, and
but we didn't get Osama bin Laden.
Yeah.
Right. Where is he? Yeah. He's been forgotten.
He has been forgotten. But this trauma center, this specialist Michael Crawford attempted suicide with a bottle of whiskey and an overdose of painkillers.
Oh, my.
So it's there's more of that to come. And our hearts, of course, as you just heard Jalene describe, go out to our neighbors, even if perhaps we're not in a neighborhood that provides a lot of the military. We can imagine this because they're like our husbands or sons or cousins or friends or whatever. But, you know, we also should have hearts that go out to the people of that region.
Absolutely.
And here are people that perhaps are, you know, they're not Taliban supporters. All they want to do is grow a little crop of poppies.
Yeah, right.
Or whatever they're growing. And there is this battle between these religious fanatics, formerly financed by the United States, our tax dollars, and this enormous American military machine. So young men come from Arkansas and Michigan and California and Montana and are, you know, coming through their village to liberate them. Yeah.
And they're not even sure who's who and what's what.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Can't imagine.
Well, with that cheery note, we will return.
You are listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jalene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
How smart is a smartphone that can't even walk and chew gum at the same time? Or for that matter, download a song while finding a decent burger joint? Point is, if you need one to run multiple apps simultaneously, it better be the magna cum laude sheer genius of smartphones. Like a droid. The perfect app running machine built to run the most powerful ones you can download and run them while running other apps. Apps from a cargo bay full of apps you can't even run on some so-called smartphones, much less at the same time. Download while you're searching, listen while you're locating, upload when you're watching. Multitasking and taking names. When there's no limit to what Droid gets, there's no limit to what Droid does.
Now you can buy one Motorola Droid for $199.99 and get a second one free, both after $100 mail-in rebate debit card per phone, only on America's largest and most reliable 3G network. Visit any Verizon Wireless store, droiddoes.com, or call 1-800-2-JOIN-IN. Both phones require new 2-year activation on a voice plan with data pack $29.99 or higher. Early termination and other fees apply. Coverage details at VerizonWireless.com.
Are you struggling with too much credit card debt, sky-high interest rates, late fees, over-limit fees? Having trouble just making the monthly minimums? We can help. We're Credit Card Relief. We've helped thousands of people become debt-free in months instead of years, all while saving thousands of dollars and without risking your family home. No, this isn't bankruptcy. It isn't one of those credit counseling deals or a high-interest consolidation loan. We're Credit Card Relief. We've been helping people just like you for nearly a decade. We're an attorney-driven program with an outstanding record of performance and client satisfaction. If you're serious about getting out of debt, call Credit Card Relief right now. Don't wait for the collection calls to start. The consultation is free, and the relief is real.
Call 866-290-8282. 866-290-8282. That's 866-290-8282.
Do you want a wireless laptop, but your credit score is holding you back? We can help. Guaranteed. If you have a bank account and can afford weekly payments of just $29.99 for 12 months, we'll send you a brand new wireless laptop, no matter what your credit looks like. Call Tronix Country now. You're approved for a brand new Dell or HP laptop. Call now and we'll also include a free MP3 player and free LCD TV with your paid order. Call 800-990-2258. Still not sure? Then hear what our customers say.
I'm really enjoying my laptop.
I just wanted to call to say how happy I am with it.
And I'm very pleased with their service, so I would suggest to anyone that is looking for computers or trying to find computers, Tronix is the best place to call.
Call now and lock in your free gifts. You will not be turned down. Call 800-990-2258. 800-990-2258. That's 800-990-2258.
Our son would go from "Good morning, Mom" to words you'd never expect to come out of your child's mouth. Our pain came from not knowing what to do. He was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia. 5 or 6 years later, he was diagnosed with obsessive compulsive disorder. I think the hardest part of living with someone who has a mental illness is thinking that you're alone, that no one else could understand. NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, is made up of people who live it every day. We lean on each other and we learn from each other. NAMI doesn't let anyone give up hope. My name is Mary Tadigan, and I can tell you what NAMI has meant for my family. It has meant that we are a family.
1 in 5 adults lives with depression, schizophrenia, anxiety, or other mental illnesses. NAMI provides education and support to these families and individuals. To find a local chapter, go to NAMI.org or call 800-950-NAMI.
McGruff the Crime Dog here with my nephew Scruff. Here's the address for my new free comic activity book.
Scruff McGruff, Chicago, Illinois, 60652. Scruff McGruff, Chicago, Illinois, 60652.
It shows kids what to know about guns and drugs and bullies and strangers. And it's got games and puzzles, too. Write it down now.
Scruff McGruff, Chicago, Illinois, 60652.
A public service message from this station, the U.S. Department of Justice, the Crime Prevention Coalition, and the Ad Council.
Hey, Dad.
What?
I can't get the ketchup bottle open.
Here, let me try. Here you go.
Thanks.
You don't have to be a hero to be a hero. When you adopt a child from foster care, just being there makes all the difference. To learn more, call 1-888-200-4005. A public service announcement brought to you by Adopt U.S. Kids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back to our second hour. Boy, it's exactly midnight here.
Sure is.
In this part of the world, you may be listening in Sweden or Finland or England or South Korea or Singapore or Australia or Mexico. I'm trying to think of where
good
people listen. Yeah. Where was I? Somebody wrote in from Georgia and sent me some stuff. I can't even remember
where
it was. Remember, you know, a couple things on my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. One thing we've been telling you about, I hope you come and join us. You can celebrate May Day with us and an end of smoking in Michigan bars, rather, with a benefit for the Fifth Estate newspaper. It features Jolene Jordan and the Dusty Picks, the D. Kroll Band, and free beer, the band. And not the beverage, at the New Way Bar in Ferndale. It's 9.5 and on Woodward at 9.5 Mile Road. Admission's only $5. Includes a one-issue subscription to the Fifth Estate magazine and a free copy of the 40th anniversary edition. All the details at Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. And let's see. Also on my website is more information about the U.S. Social Forum. You know, I was telling that to my wife, and she says, sounds like a dating thing.
Well, not so much.
No, but they have like, you know, you say social...
You might meet someone there.
Yeah, you could. Social question. You know, the social questions are like the political questions. So the social forum is this enormous gathering of, could be 10, 12, 15,000 people that are going to begin to look at what in the hell's wrong with this country and how can we begin to innovatively suggest solutions and then strategies for bringing those suggestions into being. Getting off the merry-go-round, the political merry-go-round that we're currently on. So why did I bring that up? Oh, yeah, I always say that the social forum gets no press whatsoever.
Yeah.
You can get...
Well, right here it does.
Yeah, right. You can get 700 tax demonstrators will protest on April 15th in New York City, and it gets a notice in the paper, as I'm always whining. We get a million, literally a million. And, I mean, there's 700 people arrested at those things.
Right, exactly.
And what's my favorite line? There's usually more people in the Portageon lines than there are in the entire right-wing demonstrations, except
yeah.
they get all the press.
They're the baggers.
Remember, I wasn't going to mention them at all.
Oh,
tonight.
We weren't going to say that?
That's really reducing it. That's really reducing it, though.
Well,
I mean,
yeah.
just calling them the B word.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, not even the T word.
Right.
Okay. But anyway, the Detroit News on April 13th, global gathering seeks economic solutions.
Go Detroit News.
Yeah, and the first one from Elena Harada, longtime immigrant rights advocate in Detroit and one of the many local organizers, friend of ours.
Yes.
And who I think I may ask if she wants to... be on the program. Talk a little more about that because there's all this immigration stuff going on now, again, including
Arizona.
Arizona.
Oh, my gosh. Boy, people are fired up over this one, and as well they should be, but on both sides. I only like one side.
Yeah. Governor Jan Brewer of Arizona signed this that would allow police, to stop U.S. citizens who look Hispanic and ask them to prove that they're a citizen.
Yeah.
And there was a cartoon in the New York Times today that showed somebody buying a taco.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, and then getting slammed face down.
Oh, my gosh. You know? I got to tell you, I have a friend who has a Mexican wife.
Yeah.
They live here. And he said, you will never catch me in the state of Arizona.
I guess not. But thank you for the Detroit News. There's more than 10,000 grassroots activists are coming to Detroit this summer, and they ain't right-wing. Partly because the city's image is a poster child of the global recession, which is one of the reasons that it's here. And one of the things that they think that this U.S. Social Forum will inject $11 million
kidding.
Yeah,
my gosh.
Into the economy. Yeah, people are going to come here and spend money. I know lots of people.
So even if you're on the right, you should be happy about this.
Well, yeah, I don't know how
city.
Some of these things get to be left-wing. Like, how the hell does health care get to be left-wing?
Good question.
Yeah, I never understood that. So anyways, the U.S. Social Forum, June 22nd to the 26th. You go to USSF. 2010, USSF2010.org, and you can register. A lot of unions are supporting it, and you can either go as an individual, you can go as part of a group. There's church groups, there's union groups, there's, I don't know, what you call them, environmentalists,
mm-hmm.
mentalists.
Wow. Damn.
I made that.
I didn't know.
Elected officials in Royal Oak have imposed an $180... 180-day moratorium on medical marijuana clinics as they wait to see how the state and other cities handle issues related to registered caregivers who are growing for qualified patients. They want to take a breather because they have 20 clinics want to open up in Royal Oak, which would mean you go in there and say, oh, man, I got unspecific back pain. I need some medical marijuana. And these clinics will just write it off for you.
How about the asthma one I told you about?
The asthma,
is that
yeah.
Someone I know. Yeah. I'm going to get medical marijuana because I have asthma. I'm thinking, that's smoke in your lungs. This is not going to fly.
Yeah. But essentially, if you look at the Metro Times, those clinics are saying, we will just write your script.
It seems that way.
Yeah.
I'm not real sure, how that all works.
Right. Here's Nick in Rochester Hills. Nick, hi, it's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air.
Hey, what's up, guys?
Hey.
I just want to give a shout out to the U.S. Social Forum. I'll definitely be attending that.
Oh, good.
And what I'm about to bring up here could actually be one of the biggest solutions to getting our country back on track.
What's
that? And it has to do with the financial crisis and how it's more of a crisis of capitalism than a crisis of some abstract banking sector. Because what it boils down to is the fact that these investment bankers, which are actually owners of vast amounts of capital throughout the world and our country in the form of bonds, stocks, and, of course, those infamous derivatives we've been hearing a lot about lately. Karl Marx, he actually predicted this in what he called finance capitalism, which is essentially an outgrowth of industrial capitalism and part of the process by which the whole capitalist phase of history comes to an end. So,
I'll tell you, Marx has been predicting the end of capitalism for the longest time, Nick. And mostly, though, you know, one of the things, let me give you a little piece of advice here, that there's any number of things that Marx said that that probably if you didn't put his name on it, that most people would agree to. But when most people associate, because his theories, unfortunately, were put into political reality by police state totalitarians, that when you say, you know, Marx says this or Marx says that, I don't think that's, you know, a great recommendation to most people. It's up to you.
What you're saying here.
Yeah.
But it's just the fact that like he did actually predict how these uber capitalists, which we refer to as investment bankers, are more like modern day kings and queens who have no involvement in actual production of goods and services, but are still given the right to dictate how entire industries and economic sectors operate.
Well, you know what's happened? For instance, I was reading in the New York Times business section, which if you don't read, is really where you can go online. It's just at nytimes.com. And for one thing, it's like a police rap sheet. I mean, you can imagine of all the financiers and other people connected with big businesses in this country that are always being indicted and sued and what have you. Those are only the ones that get caught. It gives you really sort of an idea of the criminal nature of finance capital, as you're indicating, I think, correctly. And also correctly was that how the stock market initially was set up to capitalize firms that an individual couldn't do by themselves. But once profit-taking and capital accumulation got to such a point that they could, that finance capital just became what we know now. It's just this huge casino where money makes money and to some extent has no real authentic value because there's no there, essentially. And I was surprised to see that they're talking about reopening, the precious earth minerals or something like that. In other words, these metals that they need for a lot of very exotic components for modern technology. And they were shopping around trying to get investors, I mean, the way that it used to be. But the reason that we've got ourselves, and maybe Nick, and in some ways I'm just repeating what you're saying, is that industrial capitalism morphed into financial capitalism, which now essentially has us by the cojones, right?
Right. And that's kind of what I wanted to offer as a solution here, which hopefully this will be talked about the U.S. Social Forum, is to democratize the workplace, where workers vote who manages, not owns, the capital they work with, and how profit is divided amongst the workers and how it should be reinvested into their particular economic sector. Because until this happens, we're going to see numerous economic collapses because the modern-day kings who own all the capital in this country have no interest in a sustainable economy where workers are paid fairly with an eye toward the future and common good of humanity.
Well, no. I mean, they're interested in getting something they're purchasing, which is our labor, at the cheapest price possible. It's what, what I've said before, it's called variable capital. Fixed capital is what they got to pay for the machinery and what have you. We're the variable capital, and if it's on the world market, if it's on the free market, like the last thing in the world any working person wants, and I mean by that, white collar, blue collar, whoever, is to have a free market of labor. And we, in fact, we want, we should want, as working people, an artificial standard of wages, which would either be dictated by the government, as it is by a minimum wage, which is pathetic in this country, should be about $3 or $4 more, or by contract through unions of employees that can set it artificially above the, you know, the market price of labor. Because if we go by the market price of labor, we're all going to be working at the same wages that people are in, you know, in China or Vietnam or something. All right, Nick, thank you. And I'll see you down there at the social forum. And, you know, you're struck by that. I just spent most of the week in New York City. And through a family member who works at this exclusive posh hotel, I just found out what posh meant. My brother-in-law told me. What the hell does that mean? Something.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Port side out, starboard. What would that be? P-O-S-H. Home.
Oh, really?
You're thinking, what the hell does that mean?
It's something to do with a boat.
Yeah. It means port side out, starboard home, which means then you're always on the good side, which I didn't make totally a lot of. That's posh, P-O-S-H, right?
Never knew.
Hello, anyway, so I was, you know, I'm a man of a fairly moderate income, but I was out there with the swells. I mean, this place had rooms in it that were $600 to $1,500 a night for the normal rooms.
Right.
And then you had the big suites that were thousands. And
so you were in a suite, right?
Yeah. And
no, you weren't.
No, I wasn't in a suite, but I was on the 34th floor overlooking Central Park.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Jealous.
And it was nothing I ever could afford if it wasn't, like I say, for this family member. That,
yes, the connection.
That worked there. And so you realize that this sector, and you go down and you look at breakfast. How much was breakfast? I think it was $40.
Yeah, for two.
Eggs. No.
For one.
For two eggs.
For two eggs?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, everything was double. So, like, a bottle of beer was $10. And,
yeah, it is expensive.
Yeah, and of course, at the same time, you have a lot of, you know, you go two blocks away and there's people sleeping on the street.
Yes.
So the deal is, how much is, how much can the system reduce the wages of how many of us and still sustain itself with a sort of an upper third?
Right.
I guess before I've called like this Guatemala model. So you have a third of the population is well-waged and lives what we consider North American or European lifestyle.
Yeah.
And then you have the bottom two-thirds that are just hard scrabble.
Right.
You know.
Extreme poverty.
Yeah. And, getting by, but not real well.
Barely.
Yeah. 313-298. WRIF, and here is Theo. Theo's in Detroit. Welcome, Theo. You're on the air.
Well, thank you, and happy Sunday to both of you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
It seems like Detroit may be in that maybe one-fourth to three-fourths category.
Yes.
But I wanted to tell you that there's a state representative by the name of Betty Cook Scott who has sent out a press release on a solution to the financial problems of the city of Detroit, and that is that the pension, which the state is trying to steal, if you will, were to loan the city $1 billion for core services, you know, the police, the fire, EMS, et cetera. And I wanted to know what you think about that, because it seems to me that the people in the city of Detroit who are city workers would continue working. They are also taxpayers. The tax would back the loan under the bond category. And it would be a better investment than some of the ones that I've heard in the past, such as the Traverse City that went belly up, the airplane investment that went belly up, the Mel Far Sun borrowed money that went belly up. So this at least would be provided to the city of Detroit for some of the needs that
sure.
the city has. Well, how do you?
Well, let me say this, Theo. I really don't know enough about it to make a judgment. And of course, the way you present it, it sounds reasonable. I mean, we have a country that's capable, given its inherent wealth, mm-hmm. to sustain every city. To sustain every state, but we're spending $1 trillion on war, and no,
right.
that's the what do they call it, the 800-pound gorilla in the room that no one ever wants to approach. Mm-hmm. And is that a solution? Is that a stopgap measure? Maybe it is. Maybe it's a good idea. But ultimately, we're funneling too much of our money into the wrong places.
I agree.
So, and one of the things you said about Detroit fitting that model that I said of Guatemala and us being in the lower two-thirds of it, capitalism has always had sacrifice zones.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of like a wheel of fortune and a wheel of misfortune. And most usually, it's been all of the third world, but sometimes in areas that previously had been very poverty-stricken, like, say, some of these, you know, like Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and all that, suddenly that becomes very wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
As you probably know, Detroit was once very prosperous, and the American South was where we said, boy, that's where the poor people live.
Right.
And so that's beginning to switch. The pie, you know, suddenly the South is prosperous. Texas, you know, that's where a lot of money is. So what we've got to figure out, as far as I'm concerned, is, you know, how do we stop those disparities? Because the only people that are ever doing anything really wrong are the people at the top.
Mm-hmm.
Because people like you and me, we go to our jobs. I mean, we're just kind of, you know, we're not the big decision makers. And we you know, we've got, like you said to me, what do I think about this? And I say, I don't know. So, and it's because, you know, we're not in that, those command positions. So if things are screwed up, as far as I'm concerned, it's the people at the top that are making really bad decisions. And if we have a world that's still racked with war, immense poverty, you know, ecological destruction, all of that, all the laundry list of problems that we almost take for granted, that we consider a definition of life, well, it is. Those all are now. But as far as I'm concerned, none of them have to be. Like, one of the slogans of the U.S. Social Forum is, another world is possible. In fact, they have it, I forgot what it is, another world is possible, another U.S. is necessary. And, I mean, I guess I would, you know, go for that. It's not a very complex slogan, but there's a lot behind it. Thank you, Theo. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
All right. And if anybody, I, like I say, I have no idea how to really evaluate it. Someone else does. Let us know. 313-298-WRIF. Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan with you. Here's Jack in Sterling Heights. Hi, Jack. You're on the air.
How you doing, Peter?
Good.
Hey, I want to bring back some heroes from the past. I don't know if you remember Joe Pyne back in 1966. He was an entertainer on TV. I think it was like Channel 50.
Yeah.
And Lou Gordon. You remember Lou Gordon?
Lou Gordon was a
phenomenal
commentator. Yeah.
Commentator, big time advocate and interviewer. Nobody would go on his show, including Bob Hopeless or Billy Graham Cracker. They would not go on his show. They were frightened of the guy. They were frightened of him. And I'd like to see Lou Gordon today, if he were still alive, because he died of a heart attack. I'd like to see, rush me some illegal painkillers, quick, Limbaugh.
Yeah.
I'd like to see him go and attack Lou Gordon, that bum.
What was what brought this all up for you, Jack?
Just thinking about you. I'm listening to your show here. It's the only thing good on tonight.
Right on.
TV stinks as usual, you know. TV's really terrible tonight.
I'm trying to think. I was Paul Krasner, who founded this paper a long time ago called The Realist. But he's still writing books, and he was on...
He was the Cuckoo's Nest author, right?
No, that was,
so that was
Kesey.
Kesey, yeah. By the way, I always get those guys mixed up.
But Mike, Ken Kesey, yeah. But remind me, I lost in my... one of the names you just said. Lou Gordon and who? What was the other guy?
Pine.
Joe Pine.
Yeah, Joe Pine, who was just awful to people, made some remark about, he said, doesn't your wife, Paul, find your acne a put-off? And so he responded by saying something like, Joe, what do you... Do you I'm not getting this across, but he had, well, like a missing arm or missing leg, didn't he?
Joe Pine? Right.
He asked him if he took off his missing leg when he made love to his wife.
Oh, my God.
So, and it all went downhill from there.
I can imagine.
Those were the great old days of television. Thanks, Jack, for the...
Not that we never...
Thanks for the memory.
Not that we never drag it down to a low level at times.
Isn't that Bob Hopeless's song?
Oh.
Thanks for the... Something like that?
I don't know.
Here's Paul in Plymouth. Paul, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, Peter, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, I just wanted to call in my support of what the governor of Arizona is doing. And I think that more states in the United within the United States should adopt that policy. I think the left side, the liberals over there, are trying to push this as, you know, we're going after, they're going after these Mexican, Latino, brown skinned people.
You don't think that's going to happen? You know, I mean, how do you tell if you're just driving down the street and you see somebody, how do you tell somebody that looks like an illegal immigrant?
Well, I mean, if you look at the policies, like I stay out in Arizona during the winter months. I'm a resident here in Michigan, and we have a Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who is out there.
He's way out there.
But he is enforcing the law.
Enforcing the law. He's making the law. Listen, once you get to the position where police have to solve a problem, it never gets solved. In other words, when you have, for instance, high crime areas and you want to have intense police patrolling and big police presence, for one thing, the crime continues because it ultimately is a compacted social problem, and the police have no capacity to control it, you know, in any definitive way. Same thing here. These people that used to come to the United States are not even coming very much anymore because our economy has gone down the drain. There's not even the jobs for them. These were immigrants from capitalism. These were refugees from capitalism, from NAFTA, essentially. NAFTA... destroyed, you know, thank you, Republicans, thank you, Bill Clinton, destroyed the Mexican rural economies, destroyed these 100-year-old traditions of, you know, of agriculture and what have you. The people in Mexico, the men particularly, some women came, but mostly men, that had the American spirit of providing for their family, or that they were adventurous, they, you know, like our relatives that, although legally, came from Europe, said they got to go where they can make some money. We've already been ruined. And most people like me are just living in the slums of Mexico City because we're so dispirited. We have no ambition. The ambitious people said, we're going to do whatever is necessary to get a job, to make some money, and that means coming into the United States illegally. So we'll spend billions of dollars on fences. We'll spend billions of dollars increasing the immigration forces. We're now going to be involved in racial profiling, no matter what the hell these people say, because I have no understanding of how they could possibly figure out who is an illegal immigrant looking at them. And you know what? It's not going to solve the problem at all.
Well, I beg to differ with you, Peter, because out there, you could never understand it here, living here in Michigan, the amount of, I'm not going to profile people, but the flood of people that are coming across the border, even without the jobs, they want to come here for a better life because they know our social system will cater to them whatever they need, health care, they want welfare, even Social Security.
Well, they don't get welfare, they don't get Social Security. If they're working here, they pay into the Social Security system, they get out nothing. So they're paying your Social Security without getting a dime back. You don't get it if you're illegal. You don't seem to address what I'm saying, that the problem has been created by the economic policies dictated from Washington with things like NAFTA, that the Mexican economy was almost destroyed by NAFTA, which created a flood, essentially, of refugees from capitalism. Remember, we used to have refugees from communism, or we still do. Baldu from Cuba, and we let him in. Well, these are refugees from capitalist policies that benefit the biggies, Wall Street, the big manufacturers, the importers, the people that have taken our jobs out of Detroit and sent them to Mexico and sent them to China. Some stuff's, you know, made in China, shipped to Mexico and here. So what do you suggest these people do?
Well, we're a nation of laws, and I think we need to uphold our immigration policies. What do you do when your federal government will do nothing? And you have millions and millions of people flooding into your towns and cities now with the violence coming across the border with the drug trade.
Sure.
I mean, what is the state supposed to do?
What does that sound like? What would be if you had to, instead of saying the you know, northern Mexico and border areas like Arizona and what have you, and you had to define that in terms of a U.S. city, what city would you say it was like? I mean, it would be like any poor urban area. It's a quality, it's a definition of poverty. And you have a situation, you have this very wealthy country right here, and then you have this artificial line called the border that was drawn by, you know, guys with guns on both sides. We gobbled up a lot of their land, and so it's real poor on one side, it's real wealthy on the other. I mean, I'm not disagreeing with that there ought to be, you know, adherence to law, and that there's not extraordinary problems created by the disparities that are there. One of the things that could happen would be that if the auto companies, Ford and these maquiladores companies, would pay a decent wage, people then would come to Sonora and these other states, because they would be getting $8 or $10 an hour rather than $2.50 an hour. So what we're going to do is call in the cops, and you say the federal government has done nothing. They put up these billions of dollars in fences, had thousands of more agents, on and on and on. And you know what? You can have that crazy Sheriff Joe, and you can have this law, and you can have 20 more laws. You can bring the National Guard out, and you know what you're going to have? Illegal immigrants, drug trades, drug gangs and what have you. You can't do it through law enforcement, is my point.
I disagree, Peter. I think we should put the military on the border. I mean, I wish you would spend, go down to the border sometime. Go down and visit once a year when the Minutemen are down there and see what happens. Go into Phoenix.
These racist militias are, you know, this is what happens. I mean, you start having these right-wing militias organizing because you say, wait a minute, this is getting out of control. And it does get out of control. You know, do you ever live in a crime-ridden urban area? I have, you know, and it's real unpleasant, and you have to have guns around your house, you have to have bars on your window, you're worried, you know, whenever a woman in your life goes out alone, you're worried yourself when you go out, mm-hmm. You know, you see kids walking down the street, and you go, oh, man, you know, like that. It's not a very nice way to live, and you know what? There's cops all over those areas, there's, burglar alarms, there's citizen patrols, and you know what? They're still crime-ridden, because it ain't about enforcement, it's about the social context in which all of this exists. Doesn't that make any sense to you?
No, I can look in both sides of the fence here, Peter. I think you're right.
No pun.
I understand your argument to the immigration issue, but it just seems like we have turned a blind eye to this for so long. I really didn't think the governor of Arizona would do anything. I think she would have said, nope, I can't do this. My constituents will go crazy. But you know what? The people there are starting to see this, the crime, the poverty is flooding in. Even without jobs, these people still want to come across the border.
Well,
everyone says, oh,
I have a lot of friends who live in Arizona who are embarrassed now to live in Arizona.
I gotta tell you another thing, Paul. There are people, for one thing, people can't go back as easily. And now there are people in Mexico sending money up here because the people, their family members, have not been able to send it back there. The immigration is slowed. Illegal immigration has slowed tremendously. I'm not trying to. The problems are still there, no doubt about it. But the process has really slowed considerably.
You had mentioned unions, and keeping our wages up. Could you imagine 2 or 3 million people coming up here from south of the border and lowering our wages even further? I mean, unions are taking hits from these lower wages here. I mean, I look at all the building that's going on here, still in my community in Plymouth, all the way to Ann Arbor. You know, your Masons.
Well, these guys aren't, I'm sure that 95% of them are legal. You don't know. See, that's the problem. What are you going to do? Say, ooh, man, I thought I heard this guy speak Spanish. Let's, up against the wall, taco head, you know, and stuff like that. I mean,
this just is not the answer.
Yeah.
This is not the answer to what you feel is a big problem, but this ain't it.
All right. Thank you. I mean, I know what you're saying. I appreciate it. And I think that it's hard for, what I'm posing is pretty huge. I mean, there's all sorts of industries, particularly one of the biggest areas is meatpacking. That
yes.
used to be the strong union of, like, all white men, which now is almost exclusively immigrants,
yes.
Somalis, mm-hmm. Mexicans, some African Americans, you know, they've been citizens for a long time, Native American people. But this is all, this is what happens in an area of in an era of economic contraction, is that people say I don't want them around, you know, they're taking our jobs, and I'm not talking about illegals necessary, people that are here without documentation, but it's what I said to Theo from Detroit. There's enough for everybody in this world. And the problem is that trying to protect small sectors of it, particularly through law enforcement, just ain't going to work.
I want to hear some revolution out there. I want to hear a revolution. Brothers and sisters, we time to test the mind. I want to know, are you ready to test the mind? Are you ready? I give you.
Peter and Jolene. You're listening to Night Call, the Riff's award-winning talk show on 101 WRIF.
Dig me up a grave and try and stick me in the ground.
Did you know the tap water in your home may be hazardous? Not to your health, but to your appliances and your wallet. Your home's hard water creates pipe-clogging limescale, and that can shorten the life of your water heater, ruin your dishwasher, and break down your washing machine. Limescale deposits block the heating element, and that could be costing you an extra $1,200 a year in energy and wear. But you can remove limescale without chemicals, magnets, or salts. It's easy with HydraCare, the patented device used worldwide. See for yourself at bestsoftwater.com. You simply clip HydraCare to your main water pipe. HydraCare removes and prevents limescale buildup in your entire plumbing system. If your home has hard water, extend the life of your appliances with HydraCare. Try it risk-free. Just go to bestsoftwater.com. That's bestsoftwater.com. Or call now, 888-883-8187. That's 888-883-8187. Do you owe back taxes to the IRS that you can't afford to pay? Or are you stuck in a tax payment plan that's getting you nowhere? The IRS is now taking very aggressive actions, such as bank levies and wage garnishments. If you owe the IRS at least $15,000, call American Tax Relief. They've helped thousands of people like you eliminate up to 85% of their delinquent taxes. Call 1-800-493-8159. If you qualify, American Tax Relief can settle your tax debt for less than you owe, remove penalties and interest, and protect you from bank levies and garnishments. As a hard-working American, you do have rights. Call American Tax Relief for a free consultation and see how much money they can save you. Call 1-800-493-8159. If you qualify, you can save up to 85% on the taxes you owe. Call right now. 1-800-493-8159. That's 1-800-493-8159.
Riff. 101.1 WRIF.
Hi, this is Mark Shemai from Creed.
Hey, everybody, this is Dave Grohl from the Foo Fighters.
Hey, it's Casey.
This is Chad. This is
Chris.
This is Brian from Cabo.
And you've got it on Detroit's rock station, 101 WRIF, the Riff.
Rocks.
Get
Detroit's Rock Station, 101 WRIF.
The Ref.
Over there? Over there's the water. Whoosh, whoosh. And look at all this stuff I'm standing on. It's called sand, and it's everywhere.
This woman may sound silly to you and me.
It's made up of little tiny pieces of rocks. Teeny little pieces of rocks.
But to her 2-year-old son exploring the world around him, she makes perfect sense.
How does it feel when you touch the sand? Is it warm?
Uh-huh.
It's hard to hold in your hand, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Learning starts long before school does, and children are naturally curious. They want to learn, so follow their lead. Take simple, everyday moments, like sorting laundry or playing on the beach, and turn them into learning moments.
Is this water?
No.
Very good. This is sand. Oh, no, no, it's not food. It's sand. We don't eat sand.
Turn everyday moments into learning moments. Find out how at pornlearning.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
When I do it, I feel the blood rushing through me. And I keep going back for more.
Carmen Castillo is under the influence of Dana, her volunteer trainer. By spending just one day a week with kids like Carmen, Dana helps them develop interests that keep them away from drugs. Be a coach, a mentor, a volunteer, because you have something to offer. Log on to helpyourcommunity.org or call 877-KIDS-313. Brought to you by the Office of National Drug Control Policy and the Ad Council.
Mom?
Dad?
How long should I wait for you?
Mom?
If I'm at soccer practice,
what if something happens?
Will you come get me?
There's no reason not to have a plan in case of an emergency.
Mom, if you're not home, should we go to the neighbor's house?
And some extremely good reasons why you should.
Can you tell me?
Everybody should have a plan. Take 5 minutes to talk about where you'll meet and how you'll get in touch with each other in an emergency. For other things you can do to be prepared, visit www.ready.gov. A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and the Ad Council.
Energy Hog, the team, infiltrate the house and waste some energy.
No problem. It's got leaky window and no attic insulation.
Perfect. Now go wild and waste some wattage.
The Mitchell House, a house like many others, except this one's under attack by Energy Hogs. They show up anywhere energy's being wasted.
Talk to me, Hogs.
The washer, it's not Energy Star rated.
Outstanding. What about the thermostat?
Not programmable.
Looks like we're living high on the hog.
Only one person has the power to get rid of Energy Hogs. You.
Hold on. Someone's home.
Andy's got energy-efficient light bulbs.
To find out how you can fight Energy Hogs, log on to EnergyHog.org. You'll find fun games and lots of tips on making your home more energy efficient.
Now he's installing Energy Star appliances.
Not Energy Star. That's it. Get out of there. I'll get you, EnergyHog.org.
Hey, wait for me.
Brought to you by the Alliance to Save Energy, the Department of Energy, and the Ad Council.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Julene Jordan.
Hi, thank you very much, and welcome back to our fourth and final segment.
That's
for
us.
Tonight at 1 a.m., a couple of interesting interviews. I was in New York all week, or most of the week,
mm-hmm.
So I have no idea
what they are.
But I was told they're interesting. They were there.
Darn interesting.
This just in, an armed man spotted at a North Carolina airport parking lot just after Air Force One departed Sunday told an officer he wanted to see the president and had a car equipped with police gear, including a siren and flashing lights.
And did he have a T-shirt on that said, I'm a teabagger?
No. It said his name is Joseph McVeigh.
Really?
Yeah. 23 years old of, how would you say this?
He wanted to talk to the president.
Coshocton,
huh?
I bet it is. Coshocton,
wow.
Ohio, is charged with going armed in terror of the public.
My gosh.
And so you got President Barack Obama was leaving after spending the weekend vacationing in Asheville and going and up and praying with Billy.
Oh, my gosh.
With
Billy Graham.
Billy Graham, yeah.
He really lost me on this one. I mean, he's done some things, but...
Yeah.
You cannot petition the Lord with prayer!
Now, airport police say they saw McVeigh get out of a maroon car with Ohio plates and that he had a sidearm.
My God.
So they took him into, his car was equipped with a clear LED law enforcement style strobe light in front and rear dash. The car also had a mounted digital camera in the front window, four large antennas on the trunk lid, and under the steering wheel was a working siren box. Smith said McVeigh, whoever Smith is, was not in law enforcement, just his hobby. Right? It's me. It's me, Abby.
Oh, yeah. My gosh.
Police said he was monitoring local agencies and had formulas for rifle scopes on a note in his cup holder.
Scary.
Yeah. They removed his sidearm and they took McVeigh into custody. They are investigating what he was doing with a gun with formulas for a rifle scopes and why his car was equipped with police gear.
Yeah. You know, there's all those kind of cop wannabes who have...
Well, then there's... Well, where is he at, though? This happened on, I guess, Monday. Carrying loaded pistols and unloaded rifles, dozens of gun rights activists got as close as they could Monday to the nation's capital while bearing arms. Hundreds of like-minded but unarmed counterparts carried out a separate rally in the nation's capital. The gun-carrying protesters in Virginia rallied on national parkland, which is legal, thanks to a new law signed by President Barack Obama that allows guns in national parks. You know, there's something called the Brady Campaign for the whole thing for gun control or something.
It was the Brady Bill that became after Reagan was shot.
Yeah. Now we've talked before about how these people, they say, you know, Obama's a gun grabber. And all these nitwits have been going and buying up guns.
He is not. He's a gun giver.
He's a giver
of the gun.
Yeah. He, you know what he's gotten in terms of a mark from the Brady campaign? An F, a total failure.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
He sure has.
Yeah. But one of the things that, I mean, when people start having political perspectives that revolve around weaponry, that gets scary. For one thing, it's almost exclusively right wing. And they always, these right wing armed formulations wind up to be fascistic. They do in Mexico. They do, well, I mean, geez, have you seen what's going on in Mexico? Mexico security officials' convoy ambushed with gunmen with assault rifles and grenades attacked a convoy carrying the top security official of the western state of Michoacán on Saturday, killing four and wounding 10 in Mexico's second brazen ambush in as many days. And previously, that wasn't the one. They were doing something else there, but they also... gunmen ambushed police officers in Ciudad Juarez, and they killed seven police officers. Now this is the Hutare. Remember, you know, those folks from Adrian, Michigan.
Yeah,
they were planning to. What was their deal? They were going to kill
a police officer and then do a roadside bomb on the way to his funeral. The funeral.
So these people are acting out, and so one of the things that almost happens exclusively with armed formations, these militias in other countries, they either become rackets, involved in drug trade, kidnapping, bank robberies, extortion, and what have you, or far-right-wing fascist groupings that wind up, like in Colombia, killing labor organizers and peasants and what have you, or usually both. And ones that have on the left as well, like in Colombia, often have a criminal side as well. So the idea that these are people just exercising their Second Amendment rights is fine. And maybe they will get no further in the world, hopefully, than that. But to start having a deal where, remember that happened last week, that the baggers were going to get together in Oklahoma and create a new volunteer militia to help defend against what they believe are improper federal infringements on state sovereignty. We're having a federal medical reform bill. Well, I'm getting my rifle out.
People are crazy.
Yeah,
truly.
They are crazy. And the right-wing militias in Europe, the black shirts in Italy, the brown shirts in Germany, the Falange in Spain, all of those armed right-wing militias turned out to destroy democracy, destroy any semblance of legitimate government, and set fascist governments in power. Now, I'm not saying that that the baggers or the Michigan militias are about to do that, or these guys that think it's important to run around a national park. If I saw people like that,
I would
Go run in the other direction.
Yeah, fast.
I am so much more frightened of the kind of whack jobs that that are fascinated with guns than I am of our government. And governments, believe it, I'm no big fan of any government.
Right.
And they are, they've existed in history primarily as a repressive force, an agency to protect the wealth of the rulers, and to a large extent still do that today in this country. But in terms of what we're looking at as a potential, I would be much more frightened to be around the self-appointed guardians of liberty that are armed and that wind up like this jerk bag.
Right, exactly.
Yeah,
he really lost it, didn't he?
Yeah.
Whoosh.
Whew. Okay. Let's go on. Here is Jason. Jason is in Sterling Heights. Hi, Jason. You're on the air.
How you doing, Peter?
Good.
Hey, love your show, man. I've been listening for a long time.
Well, thanks.
I just wanted to say real quick, I don't know if you've ever heard of this before. It just hit me this weekend. Urban agriculture within the Detroit area. Have you heard anything about this?
Well, I have. In fact, I visited a number of the farms, even. And there was a big deal on it. What was it on? What was that program called? There was just a feature on it on some national news program.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and there's a number of agricultural, in fact, in the Eastern Market, the agricultural market in downtown Detroit, they have a whole section called Grown in Detroit, and you get your veggies.
I love that.
Yeah, yeah.
We just did a fundraiser. I'm in a band. We just did a fundraiser for it over Saturday. The organization was called Fireweed. I believe they operate out of the Phoenix Cafe in Hazel Park.
That's right.
An awesome thing. And I heard you talk about, you know, two-thirds of the population being poor and things like that. And with sort of this sort of stuff popping up, I don't know, I just wanted to hear your kind of like a semi-professional opinion on what's going on down there.
I like semi.
That's funny.
Hey, Jason, that's really good of you. So what band are you in? Do you deserve a shout-out for it?
Hey, sure, why not? We're called Shotgun Soul.
What? Say it again?
Shotgun Soul.
Oh, Shotgun Soul. Yeah. Well, and Fireweed, somebody sent me a link to that, and it's a very interesting website. People should check that out. And in this, you know about this United States Social Forum that's going on in Detroit in June?
I'm not really familiar with it, no.
Okay. If you go to my website, you know how to spell my last name, Werbe, go to peterwerbe.com. Right at the top, there's information about this, and they're going to be doing a lot about urban agriculture. And, you should hook up with that. I mean, in fact, they have a whole cultural component where they're going to be having bands for, like, the whole 4 or 5 days that it's going on.
Sweet.
Yeah, yeah. If you want to just email me, calltalkyes@yahoo.com. If you can't find the other stuff, I'll hook you up to it. But good. I mean, that's great that you did that.
Oh, right on, man. Like I said, I just wanted to bring it up on your show. Love the show. Been listening for a long time, and keep the good work, man.
Thank you, Jason. Bye-bye now. Bye. Yeah. The bands are always out there doing the good stuff.
Sure are.
Yeah. Here's Virginia in East Point. Hi, Virginia. You're on the air. Hey, Virginia.
It's Regina.
Oh, hi, Regina. Oh, okay.
Okay. I'm calling because... Hi, guys.
Hi.
I read this book. It's called Gone Tomorrow by Lee Cross.
Yeah?
And I was up all night. I'm not going to cry. This is a crook. And I watched Brian Williams' show. You know, he's been in Afghanistan for years. And he did the greatest show on Nightline. You know, he showed how they blew up that valley. Did you see it?
No.
No.
So, you know what? Because it has not, the British went in, the Red Army went in, and then, you know, our army went in. It was amazing the way he did it. He said, he showed them blowing up everything. We've got to get out of here in 20 minutes. In Afghanistan?
Yeah.
Like, we have 20 minutes to get the hell out of here. They blew everything up, and then,
That was the valley that they left?
What?
That was the valley that they left.
Yeah, it starts at
the outpost.
I lent my book out to my friend, so I couldn't tell you, because, you know...
Well, wait, what's the name of it again? One more time.
It starts with a K. And I lent my book out to my friend. I couldn't call him tonight because he works early. And then, you know what they did? They cut to this soldier who's going through the Haitian recovery effort. And you know what? Brian Williams had him standing there. Oh, you should have seen Brian's eyes. And he said, I lost 8 of my friends. 47 people have died. Don't don't these people know about history? Because this valley has never, ever. They go, we went, you know what he said? We went 6 miles. And you know what? This is the book. It's called Gone Tomorrow by Lee Cross, and I read it like less than 12 hours before I saw this.
Well, it sounds like it had an enormous
impact.
I'll check it out. All right. We got to move on quickly because we're almost out of time.
Oh, we are,
but
my
thank
gosh.
You. Yeah, we're almost
gone. I wish I would have seen
Here's,
that.
Here's Lars in Madison Heights. Give us a short one, Lars. We're almost out
Where
of time.
Where have you been?
Not much. I've just been going to school.
Okay.
I wanted to talk about rentier states, but first I got to ask, how did you come to the conclusion that 2/3 of Americans are poor?
Oh, I didn't say
it
that.
It wasn't that. We were talking about Guatemala.
Saying that's the projection.
Oh, because right now our median income is still $50,000 or a little over.
I don't think the median income for white males is like $28,000.
Not what the IRS or Treasury Department says.
Well, that's maybe families, but for individuals.
Well, that's household income.
Yeah, well, that could be. But it didn't used to be like that. I mean, in other words, we've had to include more people in the workforce. You know, a lot of women are very happy to work equally with men and all that. I mean, that's come about. But previously, it wasn't an economic necessity. Now it is.
But I mean, if I understand wages have been stagnant for 30 years.
Sure.
But still, that's like the difference between, you know, that means people are making as much as they did 30 years ago, so why do they need the second income now if they're making the same amount of, if it wasn't required when you're making the same amount of wages?
Well, it's adjusted for today's dollars.
I know. I mean, adjust for inflation, it's the same, but it's like saying people have to work now. I think it's just people have a higher expectation of a standard of living, so they work the extra hours. You know,
no, that's not it at all. I mean, the top, the top 0.1%, the top 1%, the 5%, the top 10% have increased their wealth enormously, where the middle class and the working class has stagnated. We spent too much time on that, Lars. I got to get somebody else. Let's talk about this another time. All right, here is John in New Baltimore. Hey, John, you're on the air.
Hey, Pierre and Julian, how you doing?
Hey,
hi.
Great, thanks.
Hey. Good. Hey, regarding that law in Arizona, I'm just waiting for these teabaggers to come out in force, because isn't their big complaint about the government being in their lives?
They've got a lot of contradictions, and that's one of them. Yeah.
Yeah. What about example? It sounds like Nazi Germany and me. Police coming up and asking for papers?
Yeah.
If you look like an illegal immigrant.
Exactly. They should be all over. That's a
now, who looks like an illegal immigrant?
Oh, you know it's going to be the Hispanics and
you think?
Mexicans and Spanish.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I know.
So they should be out protesting this, shouldn't they?
There are a bunch of protests that are going to be happening this week.
I don't think the baggers are going to be among them, though.
Yeah.
But good point, John. Thank you very much.
Yeah, the baggers, who knows where they'll be. They're unpredictable.
Here's Kevin at the
Rouge. How you doing?
Hey, go ahead.
I'm out here in River Rouge right now getting ready to go to work. Just a couple quick things on what both of those guys are talking about. The one guy said something about the wage of the average American. Well, I am the average American. I'm a truck driver here. We haven't had a raise in my industry since 1989.
Whoa.
Steel hauler here in America.
Yeah.
I'm working for less now than I was in 1989, and the prices of the fuel have tripled, quadrupled.
Sure.
I would pay 90 cents a gallon then. It's $3.03 a gallon now.
Yep.
You know, and it's killing me and my family. And as far as, you know, the government coming into things, the papers thing is like, who looks like an illegal immigrant in America? That's what we are. We're all that.
Well, they make the point that most of our ancestors came here legally, because it's pretty hard to come into Ellis Island or something like that illegally.
Right.
Where, you know, you have a border. All right, let me leave it at that, Kevin, because I've got one more caller in about 60 more seconds. Appreciate it. Let's see. Here is Henry in Port Huron. Hi, Henry. You're on the air. Give me a headline.
Indeed, just want to call, and I was down there working in El Paso last 5-6 days, and the newspapers down there are just insane about the type of murders that are going on over there in Suarez. There's like 765 murders this year alone over there. And it's even more dangerous for the Americans even go over there. They tell you not to even go across the border over there to do anything.
Well, I think that's good advice.
God, when I was a kid, I was over across the border all the time. It's,
wow.
It's my grandparents, yeah.
All right, Henry, thank you very much. You got to be my last caller with just a short statement. Appreciate it. Jade, thank you so much for doing such a great job.
Thanks, Jade.
Answering the phones. There'll be a podcast of this show up by noon today. Jillian Jordan, thank you so much.
Thanks, Peter.
Got some terrific interviews coming, although I have no idea what they are.
They're going to be fabulous.
They're going to be fabulous. We'll talk next week.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jillian Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Jillian will be taking more of your calls right after this.
It all starts with having a good pre-screened group of contractors to choose from. And Hire It Done is your one-stop guide to finding the one that's right for your home improvement project. Hi, I'm Adam Helfman, host of WRIF's Hire It Done. Before you start your day's home improvement tasks around your house, grab a cup of hot coffee and tune us in Saturday mornings from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. Join us this week. Weekend. We'll learn why spring is the best time to redo your roof. And if you have a tax refund on the way, we'll help you make it work for you again with the top 10 home improvement projects that will save you money over and over and over again. Arnie Goodman of American Standard Roofing is back and sits down with us on the Contractor's Corner to answer all of your roofing questions. Hire It Done's money-saving tip of the week, our Green Minute. We'll head back to school at Hire It Done University, and we're going to teach you how to avoid getting scammed. Plus, I'll take your house calls live all this Saturday, beginning at 7 a.m. on Hire It Done and 101 WRIF, The Riff.
Do you want a wireless laptop, but your credit score is holding you back? We can help. Guaranteed. If you have a bank account and can afford weekly payments of just $29.99 for 12 months, we'll send you a brand new wireless laptop, no matter what your credit looks like. Call Tronics Country now. You're approved for a brand new Dell or HP laptop. Call now and we'll also include a free MP3 player and free LCD TV with your paid order. Call 800-990-2258. Still not sure? Then hear what our customers say.
I'm really enjoying my laptop.
I just wanted to call to say how happy I am with it.
And I'm very pleased with their service, so I would suggest to anyone that is looking for computers or trying to find computers, Tronics is the best place to call.
Call now and lock in your free gifts. You will not be turned down. Call 800-990-2258. 800-990-2258. That's 800-990-2258.
Are you struggling with too much credit card debt, sky-high interest rates, late fees, over-limit fees, having trouble just making the monthly minimums? We can help. We're Credit Card Relief. We've helped thousands of people become debt-free in months instead of years, all while saving thousands of dollars and without risking your family home. No, this isn't bankruptcy. It isn't one of those credit counseling deals or a high-interest consolidation loan. We're Credit Card Relief. We've been helping people just like you for nearly a decade. We're an attorney-driven program with an outstanding record of performance and client satisfaction. If you're serious about getting out of debt, call Credit Card Relief right now. Don't wait for the collection calls to start. The consultation is free, and the relief is real.
Call 866-290-8282. 866-290-8282. That's 866-290-8282.
Detroit's Rock Station. 101. The Real Riff.
My dad is my hero. He goes into burning buildings. He finds people inside who need to be saved. He helps them get out, even when he can't breathe or see or is a little scared. My dad is a firefighter, but the best thing he can do is come home.
The U.S. Fire Administration reminds you to protect yourself and firefighters. Have smoke alarms on every level and near sleeping areas. Test them monthly. Change batteries as instructed. Install sprinklers. Do your part to get out before firefighters have to come in. The fact is, most fire deaths occur in homes with no working smoke alarms. The good news is, that's a fact we can change. Smoke alarms save lives. Find out more at usfa.dhs.gov.
Our son would go from good morning, Mom, to words you'd never expect to come out of your child's mouth. Our pain came from not knowing what to do. He was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia. 5 or 6 years later, he was diagnosed with obsessive compulsive disorder. I think the hardest part of living with someone who has a mental illness is thinking that you're alone, that no one else could understand. NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, is made up of people who live it every day. We lean on each other and we learn from each other. NAMI doesn't let anyone give up hope. My name is Mary Tadigan, and I can tell you what NAMI has meant for my family. It has meant that we are a family.
1 in 5 adults lives with depression, schizophrenia, anxiety, or other mental illnesses. NAMI provides education and support to these families and individuals. To find a local chapter, go to NAMI.org or call 800-950-NAMI.
101 The Riff.
Okay. Look at those numbers.
Woo! Look at those numbers! Yeah! Can you believe we get paid to do this? It's only Monday! It's only Monday!
Excited about what you do? Well, pass it on. As a Junior Achievement volunteer, you can bring your enthusiasm to the classroom and give a few kids a little something extra to get excited about, their future. Share a little something of yourself. Be a JA volunteer.
For information on how you can get involved, log on to JA.org.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. You know, I just got a... in fact, I was talking on the phone to a friend of mine, and he said, why won't you get on Facebook? And I said, why? And he says, because then, you know, we could exchange messages. I said, hello, we're doing that on the telephone. And the other thing, he said, well, what about, you know, when we contact each other by email? I said, well, what's wrong with email? And he said, well, I get to see your face. So I don't know. I'm kind of a 20th century boy, but the 21st century has opened up certainly a revolution in how we conceive of ourselves publicly. Incredible book has come my way. It's called The Peep Diaries, P-E-E-P, How We're Learning to Love Watching Ourselves and Our Neighbors. And the author is Hal Nedvietsky, and he has written lots of stuff I think that is pretty interesting. He's the founder of Broken Pencil Magazine, the author of Hello, I'm Special, How Individuality Became the New Conformity. Also, he's written We Want Some Too, Underground Desire, and the Reinvention of Mass Culture. His writings have appeared in the New York Times Magazine, The Playboy, The Walrus, Adbusters, Udney Reader, lots more. Hal is a subject. He's got an upcoming documentary called The Peep Diaries, and actually the title itself has an interesting double meaning to it. It's published by City Lights. We're reaching Hal Nedvietsky in Washington, D.C., although he's centered in Toronto. He's on the road. Ned, welcome to the broadcast. Hal, rather, sorry. Welcome to the broadcast.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Yeah. You know, there's a song, I don't know, kind of an obscure Rolling Stones song called Fingerprint File, where that Mick Jagger sings, there's no privacy, it's all secrecy. Well, there's no privacy, but there's virtually no secrecy anymore either, is there?
No, I mean, you know, secrets are an outmoded method of getting people to be interested in you.
Well, it is, and just personal space seems to be disappearing. You sit next to somebody on a plane, and you're kind of just chatting with them, and they start telling you they have erectile dysfunction or something like that. I mean, it's too strange. But what the Peep Diaries, How We're Learning to Love Watching Ourselves and Our Neighbors, explain the subtitle, because I think that's the crux of what you're writing about.
Mm-hmm, sure. Basically, I argue in the book that we are moving from a pop culture, a popular culture, to a peep culture. And in pop culture, we watched a lot of celebrities and sort of anointed talents do their performances, their songs, their dances, their acting. And that's how we spent our leisure time. In peep culture, we are starting to watch ourselves, our neighbors, strangers around the world. We're watching their everyday lives. And that's becoming our entertainment. So basically, you know, it's a shift. It's a shift from pop culture to peep culture that I believe is really teaching us to love watching ourselves and our neighbors. And that's where the subtitle and the main title come from.
Mention the double meaning of the peep diaries, though, for people.
Well, I mean, in my mind, you know, you have maybe quadruple meanings. Of course, you have peeps, the peeping Tom idea, that we're all becoming peeping Toms. There's a kind of slang lexicon for peeps, my peeps, which is kind of my people, and I think we're connecting. We're connecting with people through peep culture in different ways, and then there is, of course, the famous works of Samuel Pepys as well.
And you know, it used to be people that were there was the phrase. It sounds very early 20th century now. A busybody, someone who was peeping into the lives of other people. That was a real derogatory expression. And peeping Toms that you began. Mm-hmm. You began one of your first chapter with an early definition of that from 1796, Dictionary of the Vulgar Tongue. Peeping Tom, a nickname for a curious, prying fellow. And even worse, it's usually someone who's looking in at a woman who is in a state of undress or undressing. Yet all of those boundaries are gone, aren't they?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we have to ask ourselves now, well, what happens to a society where we're all peeping Toms, where, in fact, we're encouraged to be peeping Toms? And I take that line throughout the book. Where are we going with this? What does our morality look like? And what are the implications on our everyday lives when we literally want to watch each other all the time?
Yeah, it takes up a lot of time, though. That's one of the reasons that I don't have a Facebook page, is that if I have to do one more thing on a computer, my brain will capsize. So it's both commodified in the sense that, or commodification, and maybe I'm not even using that word entirely correctly, but you have to have the hardware, the software, all the little elements of peeping, and then you have to invest the time as well. Something that even as short a time ago as 20 years ago, No one had cell phones or iPods, which I guess are kind of even a little early 21st century now, right?
Well, you know, since the rise of kind of industrialism, we have had a lot of time on our hands, and we've sort of segmented our lives into work and leisure in ways that people never did before, where you would often, you know, you would work and have your leisure, because by the time you're finished working, you were just about ready to pass out. And now we have all this time on our hands, and that's really where pop culture came from, was... But people would go to work, and then they would come home, and they wanted to be entertained. And they had time, and they had extra money to spend. So this class of professional entertainers arose to fulfill that need in our, you know, capitalist society. Now we're seeing a shift in kind of who entertains who, and increasingly we're sort of entertaining each other, which we can do now because of these technologies. Ultimately, if we shift, 50% of our television time into blogging, Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, et cetera, that's a tremendous amount of time and energy that we're now putting into revealing our own lives and looking at other people's lives.
Sure. Well, the whole idea that Facebook, things like that, overcome people's isolation, which was also began with industrial society, is that more convivial society began to collapse. Public life, the idea of cafe society and street life, that's disappeared in most major cities and towns around in the Western world. Yet people say, oh, you know, I've got 400 friends and what have you. And I remember somebody came up to me. I can't tell too much of the circumstances, or it'll give away to someone who's listening. But they said, so-and-so has defriended me. And I went, wow. And I thought, wow, having no idea what he was talking about. So then I went and talked to the other person, and they explained it was a Facebook deal. Now, maybe you could give us, you had 800 online friends, and you called a Facebook party. Can you tell us that story?
Sure. I'll tell you the story. It was something I did. I was coming out of 2 years of being a new father, and you really fall into that bubble, and you tend to drop out of the social world. And I'm being a garrulous exactly overflow with friends in the first place. So I kind of came out of this and said, you know, I don't really have any friends left anymore. but the strange thing, of course, is that when you're home all the time, you end up being online a lot. And so I was on all these different social networks quite a bit, and I realized that I had 800 Facebook friends. No friends in real life. So I said, okay, I'm going to revitalize my social life and invite all these people to meet me at a local bar, you know, see if we could make a face-to-face connection. So I invited all these people. About 30 said they were definitely coming. About 60 said maybe, you know, several hundred said no, and the rest just ignored it altogether. So I thought, okay, 30 coming, 60 maybes. I really was just setting, I let the bar know that 40 people were coming, to party with me. Unfortunately, and perhaps even unbelievably, only one person showed up.
Sorry.
Thanks, Peter. Appreciate the laugh there. You know, I basically spent the night on my own.
Yeah.
Which was a quite fascinating experiment, really. You know, it was painful to go through, but ultimately very revealing, because when I went back and contacted each person who had said they were coming or maybe coming, I got very revealing results of why they didn't come. They would say, well, I was going to come. I always say yes to these things on Facebook, but that doesn't mean anything. Everyone knows that. I live in a different country. I said, well, if you live in a different country, you know, why would you say yes? Well, you know, people, I want to make it seem like I have a lot of exciting social life, and so I say yes to a lot of things that I would like to go to, even though I know I'm never going to go to them. So, you know, we're very comfortable with connecting through screens, through media. That's very much how we have grown up, especially, you know, I'm 38, and my generation and the generations who are coming up now, we're really comfortable connecting through screens. But when we're asked to break out of the screen and meet face-to-face, we start to come up with a lot of reasons why we don't want to do that.
Well, it sounds like there's new boundaries.
There are. I mean, you know, you're sort of like, well, you have a Facebook friend. A Facebook friend is not a real-life friend. And to ask someone to move from Facebook friend to real-life friend is somehow transgressing an invisible, unwritten boundary or rule. It's like assuming that a conversation you have with someone next to you in the airplane is going to lead to a friendship. And, you know, it's just a really interesting thing. So then you say to yourself, well, what are these, what are Facebook friends? What are MySpace followers? What are Twitter followers? What are the people who read and comment on my blog, or watch my YouTube videos? What are these people to me? And I think a lot of the answer, is, well, they are people who are using my life, as entertainment. They may get other things out of it, just as when we watch TV, we may get, ideas and other things besides entertainment, but the primary thing that we want to do is kill time, is pass time, you know, in a leisurely, enjoyable way.
Sure. The book is The Peep Diaries, How We're Learning to Love Watching Ourselves and Our Neighbors. My guest on the Peter Werby Show is Hal Netwiecki. It's published by a wonderful publisher, City Lights, citylights.com, and Ned's website for the book is thepeepdiaries.com. There'll be a link on my site as well, peterwerby.com. You know, you wind up, though, as you said, wondering about the content of friendship and what that even means. I mean, friends used to have imply a deep personal commitment. You had a responsibility to another person if you said that they were friends, and that whole idea of best friend or best friends, and now it seems fairly eroded.
Yeah.
As you said.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I'll tell you a story, if I may.
Yeah.
When I was writing the book and sort of investigating this phenomenon, I went to the offices of Twitter, which, as we now know, is you know, the hottest thing since sliced bread. 140 character or less status updates of what you're doing right now, and has sort of captivated millions of people. At the time when I saw them, they were still kind of a fledgling startup, and many considered them to be on the lunatic fringe of social networking, and I sat down with them and I said, you know, guys, a lot of people say you're completely crazy. Why would anyone ever want to use this service? And they said to me, it's going to catch on. It's going to be very popular because it allows people to have connection with low expectation. And that to me resonates throughout all aspects of deep culture, this idea of connection, low expectation. We want to have a social life. We want to have a lot of friends. We want to feel fulfilled and feel like we live in community, but we don't want to have the imposition of community and friendship. And so we want connection, but we don't want to have expectations put on those connections.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if people have both, though. I was thinking about that. I mean, there's one person I know that involves himself. Actually, two people, a man and a woman separately, have large Facebook connections, yet I notice they have a lot of personal friends, too. And they're always texting, and they're always doing their Facebook. And then, you know, they also have quite a large social life. When I think about Facebook any of the rest of it, it just strikes me as one more task that I have to do. Some people said, why don't you keep a journal? I said, I don't want to go home every night and, you know, I mean, this is like writing in a, you know, a book in a journal.
It is work. It's definitely work. And, I mean, to your first point, absolutely. There are a lot of wonderful things about these kind of deep culture technologies. And one of those wonderful things is that we can keep in contact with people in different ways that extend and enhance our friendships. So it's not all negative, not by any stretch of the imagination. And there are certainly people with lots of real life friends who also use these mediums. But I think you are giving something away when you use these mediums. You are changing your relationships. People have said to me, you know, I had a good friend from high school who lives across the country, and we would make a point that we would talk once a week. And then we both joined Facebook, and now we don't talk anymore. Mm-hmm. Now we just talk through Facebook and look at each other's profiles. So, you know, you do have limited time, and you do end up choosing how are you going to connect with people. And the more we connect through these mostly corporate-owned, for-profit sites, which exist to facilitate a certain kind of peeping into other people's lives, the more that changes our concepts of relationships and friends and communities. And I think it's hard to get around that. You know, and the other point you were making about time and energy, increasingly younger generations and even, you know, and a lot of people in the marketing business are talking about your personal brand, so that this becomes an extension not just of your social life, but of your entire kind of aura as a human being. And people are going to go to your Facebook page or your blog and say, what's this person all about? What is their brand? And so it becomes a kind of work, a constant selling of yourself.
Well, I wonder, on the front of your book, The Peep Diaries, you have a quote by the wonderful Naomi Klein, the author of The Shock Doctrine, where she says about this book, The Peep Diaries, a snapshot of a world in profound transformation, compelling and creepy. But she's also written, I can't remember the name of her book, about branding. And
No Logo, that's right.
No Logo, right. And so she would probably find that idea of personal branding even more creepy.
I think a lot of people find that creepy, and for those of us who wonder about the extent to which people are willing to fuse their identities with kind of a sort of corporate construction, so, you know, you are your own brand, you know, a lot of us are wondering, is that really where we want to go as human beings? You know, if we kind of look around the world and see where that kind of logic has taken us, you know, into rampant consumerism, obsessive narcissism, and all the things that come along with that, you know, there are a lot of negatives, which unfortunately we don't really talk about that much. We always hear, oh, this exciting new technology, oh, you're left behind if you're not on this or that or the other. But when do we ever stop and say, you know, there are also subtle side effects that sort of burrow into our minds and our lives that should really be considered.
In the peep culture, well, I'm just looking at our time, and every so often, because I know people listen frequently to radio and cars, I should reintroduce both of us. This is the Peter Werby Show, and I'm talking with Hal Nedviatsky, who's written The Peep Diaries, How We're Learning to Love Watching Ourselves and Our Neighbors. You know, the concept of scandal, I was just watching the 1963 movie Tom Jones, which is set in the middle 18th century, and there was great scandal. People were ruined by by what they were caught doing, and I was thinking about this South Carolina governor Mark Sanford and this torrid affair he had with a Latin lover and all that. And had he not been so hypocritical about being a guy who's talking about Christian morality and family and all that, I suspect it probably wouldn't have raised an eyebrow in the way that it did in a previous period. In other words, that all of our lives seem to be open books. All of us have foibles. We know that it's pretty easy after years of marriage to be attracted by someone else, and some people fall for the lure. But I suspect in a peep culture that is scandal, the sense of scandal, actually reduced.
I think it's it's a commodity. If you can generate a scandal around you and manage it properly, you can come out ahead. And people manufacture scandal all the time. The best example, of course, is the celebrity sex tape, where you say, this looks awfully professionally done to be an accidentally escaped sex tape. And isn't it funny how it accidentally escaped just at the moment that the TV show is coming out,
Well, Pamela Anderson, people have said that more people have watched her having sexual intercourse than anyone else in the history of the world.
Yeah, precisely.
And yet, no one says, out, you can no longer darken our door. You know, it's just...
Right. I mean, in the peep culture, scandal is a commodity. If you have something intimate and scandalous about yourself, well, that's a great way to get attention. And attention means numbers, and numbers means ratings. And so, this is what we come down to when we start thinking, I've got my blog, and I need something exciting to happen in my life, so that people will read this thing. We start to really live sort of parallel lives: one life in the flesh, and one life in a cyberland where everything that happens can be sort of converted into the scandalous bits of entertainment.
You're working on a documentary called The Peep Diaries, the same name as your book. What's going to be in that?
It's sort of taking off from where the book ends, trying to put my life out there in many different ways. For instance, life casting, which is where you sign up on something like Justin.tv, and you get your own channel. And you broadcast 24 hours a day through webcams in your house as much as possible. So I've been doing that, which is, fascinating. I was just trying out for reality TV and on the set of a show called Solitary, which is a show done by Fox Reality, the Fox Reality All Reality 24-hour cable network, cable channel, and they are making this show in which they put people in a pod and they are observed 24 hours a day and subjected to various treatments and tortures until only one remains standing in their isolation. So things like that. I've sort of just been exploring the ideas in the book, in the documentary, and doing some things which I didn't have opportunity to do before, but now some more doors are opened little higher budget for television. So,
okay. Well, you know, you talk in the Peep Diaries about the Peep culture changing the world. I wonder sometimes. I haven't really tracked this very much, but I for a while thought all this was going to be like the CB phenomena of, when was it, like the 70s or something. And after a while, other than the people that really utilized it professionally, truck drivers, people just got kind of tired of it. But it doesn't seem that people are tiring of Twittering or Facebook, or is it too early?
I don't think this is a trend that's going to max out. I think that, you know, individual brands become trendy and then move on. So, for instance, you know, we were all on Friendster. And then we were all on MySpace, and now we're all on Facebook. Those things change, but the idea of putting your life out there, of creating this sort of cyber brand and this constant stream of information about you and shutting down for a night of watching other people's lives, I don't think that's going anywhere. You know, I was just spending some time with a group of 20-year-olds for the documentary and a group of friends who all constantly update their Twitters and have three different blogs going and constantly making videos and taking pictures and putting them on Flickr. And, you know, and the way they have fused this into their lives is remarkable. It is just a never-ending stream of information. And you go to a party with them and they are all in separate corners sending out text messages and status updates.
That's too weird. You go to rock concerts or any concert. I would say rock concerts, and because it's not true, the symphony or the opera. And people are just texting away. Probably, oh, this is so cool. They're playing blah blah blah.
You've got to know what's happening right this second.
The idea though of losing two things: solitude and the capacity to focus and not spend your whole life multitasking. Hey, I'm gonna leave it with my little editorial there, because we're completely out of time. There's so much more in the Peep Diaries, how we're learning to love watching ourselves and our neighbors, by Hal Nedvietsky. It's published by City Lights. Go to citylights.com, or you can go directly to thepeepdiaries.com. Also, my website, Peter Werbe, werbe.com as well. And Hal, where should we look for your documentary?
Well, that's going to probably air not for a year or so, and it's a CBC, Canadian Broadcasting Company production that will hopefully also have an American broadcaster. For those of you in the Detroit area, you can probably catch the Canadian airwaves.
Our neighbor to the south, Windsor.
Yeah, exactly. It's not happening for a good while yet. So right now, you can go to thepeepdiaries.com and see little clips in progress.
Thank you so much for being on the Peter Werbe Show.
Oh, my pleasure, Peter. Anytime.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
April showers bring you big ways to save on everything from golf, wine tasting parties, kayaks, fitness classes, Botox, Zoom teeth whitening, and so much more. Log on to MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com and check out the amazing items up for bid at the Motor City Steals and Deals Spring Online Auction. With almost $100,000 worth of items up for grabs, you're bound to find something you'll want to bid on and win. Get in on the Spring Showers of Savings Online Auction right now at MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com.
Did you know the tap water in your home may be hazardous? Not to your health, but to your appliances and your wallet. Your home's hard water creates pipe clogging line scale, and that can shorten the life of your water heater, ruin your dishwasher, and break down your washing machine. Lime scale deposits block the heating element, and that could be costing you an extra $1,200 a year in energy and wear. But you can remove lime scale without chemicals, magnets, or salts. It's easy with HydraCare, the patented device used worldwide. See for yourself at bestsoftwater.com. You simply clip HydraCare to your main water pipe. HydraCare removes and prevents limescale buildup in your entire plumbing system. If your home has hard water, extend the life of your appliances with HydraCare. Try it risk-free. Just go to bestsoftwater.com. That's bestsoftwater.com. Or call now, 888-883-8187. That's 888-883-8187. Do you owe back taxes to the IRS that you can't afford to pay? Or are you stuck in a tax payment plan that's getting you nowhere? The IRS is now taking very aggressive actions, such as bank levies and wage garnishments. If you owe the IRS at least $15,000, call American Tax Relief. They've helped thousands of people like you eliminate up to 85% of their delinquent taxes. Call 1-800-493-8159. If you qualify, American Tax Relief can settle your tax debt for less than you owe, remove penalties and interest, and protect you from bank levies and garnishments. As a hardworking American, you do have rights. Call American Tax Relief for a free consultation and see how much money they can save you. Call 1-800-493-8159. If you qualify, you can save up to 85% on the taxes you owe. Call right now. 1-800-493-8159. That's 1-800-493-8159.
101 WRIF.
Everything that rocks.
101 WRIF.
What's up, everybody? This is Sully from Godsmack.
Hello, Motor City. This is Mike McCready from Pearl Jam.
Hello, Motor City. This is Peter Page from Led Zeppelin. Your radio's locked on 101 WRIF. If it rocks, it's on the roof.
Everything that rocks. 101 WRIF.
Everything that rocks.
Energy hog to team. Get in that house and waste some energy.
No problem. It's got leaky windows and no attic insulation.
This house is under attack by energy hogs. They show up anywhere energy's wasted.
The washer, it's not Energy Star rated.
You have the power to get rid of energy hogs.
Someone's home!
He's got energy efficient light bulbs.
Go to energyhog.org for fun games and lots of hog busting tips.
Energyhog.org? That's it! Get out of there!
Wait for me!
Brought to you by the Alliance to Save Energy, the Department of Energy, and the Ad Council.
I'd like a nice skim, no whip latte.
Hey, you're the Red Defender, right?
Yes.
I saw you in the paper. You saved a runaway train.
That's right.
So shouldn't you be out saving something?
I already stopped the bank heist this morning.
Evil doesn't take a break.
Can I sit down for a second?
Hey, dial back the caffeine, man.
Saving the world isn't easy. Saving a life is. One pint of blood can save up to three lives. Go to bloodsaves.com. A public service message brought to you by the Ad Council.
Want to fight childhood asthma? Then fight it with a scrub brush and a hot soapy towel. Even in the neatest and tidiest homes, if there's so much as a crumb to eat or a drop to drink, household pests like bugs and mice will do all that they can to get it. Creepy crawlies like bugs and mice are unpleasant enough as it is, but they're more than just a nuisance for kids with asthma because they can actually trigger an asthma attack. So, give them a whole lot of nothing. Sweep up crumbs, wipe down tables, scrub dishes before they pile up in the sink, and store leftovers in plastic bags or bowls. Don't leave them so much as one tidbit or nibble, and you can stop a childhood asthma attack before it starts. Discover other simple ways to prevent an asthma attack. Call 1-866-NO-ATTACKS or visit noattacks.org, because no child should feel like a fish out of water. A public service message brought to you by the U.S. EPA, the Ad Council, and this station.
Hey, Dad.
What?
I can't get the ketchup bottle open.
Here, let me try. Yeah, stuck all right.
Anything?
Now watch. If you take your palm like this and smack it on the bottom right here, you can get it open pretty easily. There you go.
Thanks.
You don't have to be a hero to be a hero. When you adopt a child from foster care, just being there makes all the difference. To find out how you can adopt, please visit our website at AdoptUSKids.org or call 1-888-200-4005. A public service announcement brought to you by Adopt US Kids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Welcome to the broadcast. Peter Werby here with you. We're going to turn today to one of my subjects that always intrigues me, and that's history. Figuring that we have to know what happened in the past in order to figure out what's happening today and what we want to see for the future. And coming back as a second appearance on the Peter Werby Show is Bruce Chadwick. He's a former journalist and author of 8 books of history, including the one we last talked with him about. I think it was about 5 or 6 years ago, The Real, in terms of R-E-E-L, Real Civil War, films about the Civil War and the meaning that they portray. Bruce Chadwick teaches American history, and he lectures there at Rutgers University and also teaches writing at New Jersey City University. We're speaking to him in the land of Bruce Springsteen. Bruce Chadwick, welcome back to the Peter Werby Show.
Well, thank you for having me. And remember, too, the New Jersey is also the land of Tony Soprano.
There you go. Well, I'll be careful then. I'll be really careful. Your brand new book is 1858, Abraham Lincoln, Jefferson Davis, Robert E. Lee, Ulysses S. Grant, and the War They Failed to See. Yeah, I was just thinking about a book that I probably read a long, long time ago. It was published in 1978 by the late Barbara Tuchman, a wonderful historian. It's called A Distant Mirror, The Calamitous 14th Century. And essentially what she was doing was going way back to the 14th century and giving us a look at today's world. Is that embedded in your brand new book, 1858, as well, or is it just pure history?
No, the 1858 doesn't really reflect any era in America or Europe, and that probably was one of the problems, in that the great struggle involved with people, North and South, over slavery, there really wasn't a other than simply outlawing slavery legislatively, there weren't any precedents to end it. And they kept struggling throughout the 1850s, trying to figure out some way to make slavery palatable for people. And they couldn't. And that's what brought on the Civil War in 1861. And what my book is sort of like a look at 1858 as sort of a springboard for the country into the Civil War.
Well, I'm thinking, though, it's 150 years, 1858, 2008. I guess what I was saying was...
If that reflects today.
Yeah, are there messages there for today? Yeah.
Well, I think it reflects a strong regionalism in the country that we certainly have today between Northerners and Southerners and East Coast versus West Coast people. The difficulties Americans still have today after all these years with race as a problem in American society, underscored by Senator Obama, who now is going to be the Democratic nominee, which is, to me, a marvelous idea that an African-American here 150 years later could run for president of the country that was enslaved in 1858.
Well, Bruce Chadwick, tell us about the structure of your book, 1858. You mentioned, of course, personalities that probably every single person listening knows. Lincoln, Jefferson Davis, Robert E. Lee, the general and then President Grant, and the war they failed to see. Kind of give us the structure of 1858 and what roles they were playing at the time.
Well, what I tried to do, instead of writing just the chronicle of the calendar year, which I thought would be a little bit dry and boring, let me backtrack one bit. I wrote a book on the Underground Railroad a few years ago, and part of that book was a very highly publicized rescue of a guy, a slave, that slave catchers had abducted in Oberlin, Ohio, which hundreds of people from Oberlin and the surrounding areas of Ohio jumped in to rescue this guy. And that, plus the idea that Lincoln ran for the Senate that year and had his debates with Stephen Douglas, was sort of the spur for this book. So the structure of the book is like 8 or 9 different individual stories tied together to each other with the fight over slavery and the changing political look of the country. And there was a lot of emphasis on the fact that President Buchanan, the president who was elected in 1856, was pretty ineffective as a president and exhibited very little leadership at a time that the country needed it. And I'm hoping that when people read the different chapters and the stuff on Buchanan, they'll sort of connect them all together to see what a turbulent year that was.
Mm-hmm. And when people blithely say that George W. Bush, as so many people have contended, is the worst president in American history, they ought to read a little history as well, right?
Buchanan's got Bush beat.
Yeah, you think so?
He does.
Give us some of the elements of President Buchanan that that you make that assessment of.
Well, I tell you, he was a strange guy. He continually would tell people that he wanted to be detached as the president. He didn't want to get involved in things. And in fact, he became so detached that years later, when he wrote his autobiography, he wrote it in the third person.
Well, there you go.
He continually told people throughout 1858 and 59 and 1860 that slavery was no longer an issue in the United States, that the Dred Scott decision in 1857 had ended slavery as a source of contention, which it had not. It had just built it up as a fiery source of contention.
Remind us about the decision in
the Dred Scott decision ruled that slavery was legal.
Yeah.
Slavery was legal, that it overturned the Missouri Compromise and legalized the Fugitive Slave Act, which made it lawful for people to go to the northern states and arrest slaves who had run away from plantations earlier. And Buchanan just kept insisting that slavery was no longer a problem. In the 1858 year, it grew as a problem, and he just ignored it. When, if he had used the power of the White House, it's possibility he could have achieved some sort of a settlement that might have averted a war.
Well, part of the subtitle, Bruce Chadwick, of your brand new book, 1858, The Men and the War, they failed to see. It seems to me that foreseeing a war of the magnitude that the United States experienced, to foresee that would have probably almost been impossible. Or do you think they were short-sighted?
They were not short-sighted. They genuinely did not think that the issue would get out of hand to the point where one half the country would be engaged in a bloody conflict with the other half. The Southerners had threatened to secede. Southerners had threatened a bloody conflict of some kind. But they had done it so long. It's like crying wolf. You know, they had done it for so long, so many decades in so many places, that people just didn't believe them. But it happened.
When you say the Southerners, though, are we talking? The army, all the army garrisons and bases and troops that were stationed in the South, of course, were part of the United States Army. And who was making these threats? Is this like state leaders or slave owners or
Southern governors, senators, congressmen? Constantly would do it. And there was one Northern senator, I forget his name, on a particular night in Washington when a whole bunch of Southern leaders, this is in the 1850s, were ranting that they were going to secede and there would be a civil war and this and that. And this Northern senator, he said, let them talk. They'll give their speeches and they'll go across the street, have a drink, and they'll come back.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the view of people from the North, just let them talk. And they just didn't see it. They just didn't foresee the war that came. Neither did the Southerners. They never foresaw it. And that was part of the problem, because when the war did start, certainly neither side was prepared for it in terms of soldiers or munitions or forts, prisoner of war camps. I mean, they weren't ready for any of that, and it made the war far more brutal than it might have been.
Yeah, my great-great-grandfather actually was, having been wounded and survived, which was a thing in itself for that war, when he recovered, he was a guard at a prisoner of war camp, and one of the Southern prisoners carved a cane for him because he was limping, and it still remains in our family.
Huh.
Yeah.
See, that's interesting.
Yeah. Bruce Chadwick is my guest. The book is 1858, Abraham Lincoln, Jefferson Davis, Robert E. Lee, Ulysses S. Grant, and the War They Failed to See. A lot of theories about the Civil War. One of them is called irrepressible conflict, that there was virtually nothing that could be done given the contentious elements involved. Do you subscribe to that theory?
It's hard to analyze that theory. William Seward came up with that phrase, the irrepressible conflict, and bellowed away that country was going to be all slave or all free, as Lincoln had done in the House Divided speech. But I don't think that Seward or Lincoln or any people that talked about that, truly thought that it would end up in a bloody civil war. I think they thought it would wind up in a big political mess and nothing beyond that. It's really hard to talk about the Civil War because right up until the last couple of weeks before it started, people on both sides thought they could stop it. And it just rolled out of control in the last couple of weeks.
These men weren't personal arch enemies, or were they, like Lincoln,
no.
Davis, Lee, and Grant?
Not at all. The interesting thing to me is that when Jefferson Davis in 1858 almost died of this chronic herpes condition he had, he's bedridden for a number of weeks.
I thought it didn't come about to the 1970s, but I guess it was around before, huh?
Herpes?
Yeah.
Yeah, there was a lot of it going around.
Yeah.
People would contract it the same way you do today.
Yeah.
But there wasn't any medicine, though, and you'd be stuck with it all your life. And Davis, whenever he was under great stress, would come down with it. So he goes off and becomes the president of a country in a war. Think he's not going to have any stress.
Sure.
But he almost died in the winter of 1858. And who was at his bedside all the time, as he always was, whenever Davis was sick, because he was Davis's best friend, but William Seward, the radical leader of the anti-slavery movement from New York. They were close personal friends, yet diametrically opposed to each other on politics.
Well, there's another explanation. I'm trying to, my professor at Michigan State would say, you don't remember this all cold, Mr. Werby, which I'm, the other thing was essentially a Marxist interpretation that, that there were class forces clashing, that for one thing, who was going to rule America, that almost all or maybe all of the presidents up until 1860 had been Southerners, and the wealth of the South and was, of course, based on agricultural wealth and slave ownership. And this was a clash between the industrial North and the agricultural South. That was one of the driving forces towards that, that it wasn't just sort of mindlessly blundering into something that no one had any control over. I mean, although it had aspects of that.
It was, and it was underscored by the idea that people in the North really resented leadership people in the South contending again and again that the percentages of people in the South, the power that people in the South had in Congress was far greater than the percentage of population they had in the country, and that the South was really running the country, and because the South was running the country, they constantly protected slavery.
And that was part of their base. They could count slaves as, what was it, 3/5 of a person.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And another part of that, and part that Abraham Lincoln pushed mightily in all of his political life, was the plea to northern free people who worked in the Industrial Revolution in factories under pretty poor working conditions. And his pitch to these people was this: you're a slave, too. You're a slave to the factory boss. You make very little money. You work 6 days a week. You live in, you know, terrible hovel-type housing. You're a slave now under those conditions, just like blacks are in the South. There's no difference. So whatever's done to blacks in the South is being done to you. And this worked for Lincoln. It got a lot of wage earners in factories in the North in favor of, against slavery.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's been a lot of revisionist history, revising the official histories, and I just heard an astounding interview with the right-wing conservative, Pat Buchanan, who essentially was arguing that World War II had never been fought, and had it not been that the Holocaust wouldn't have happened, all this 20 to 30 million, they don't even know how many people perished, never would have occurred. There's also the argument that that the Civil War never really had to be fought, that there is nothing inherent in the Constitution that prohibited secession, and that it was only Lincoln's intransigence about maintaining the integrity of the, you know, the original. I know this has been debated a lot, but and that eventually that slavery would have become economically unviable, and so the what's the figure? 600,000 men that died, and how many, hundreds of thousands more wounded, like my great-great-grandfather, that didn't have to occur. What do you think?
People have made the argument that slavery would simply fall apart because it had no economic viability. for 100 years. And different people, including many Southerners, were against slavery and certain that it would collapse, as it had in the Central and South American countries where it had thrived for hundreds of years. Yet it didn't fall apart. So people in the North would point that out. On the secession, a lot of people in the North, when the secessionists started, took the attitude, let them go.
Yeah.
Let them form their own country. Let Texas be its own country. Let California be its own country. Fine by us. They'll collapse. They need the United States. They need a big country to function in. There's that view, too. Lincoln insisted that the country had to be one whole republic and raised an army to fight that war. Now, you could argue the other way, that these people were entitled to secede, but if they had seceded, I mean, really, for them and for us and for everybody, I think it would have been a bad idea to have what is the United States cut up into three or four different countries.
Mm-hmm.
And they would have been at each other's throats.
There was great enthusiasm, of course, among many of the northern population and its soldiers. There was, of course, a draft, but on the other hand, there were a great number of volunteer units, like the one that my great-great-grandfather fought in. And they saw this as a crusade to maintain the Union and to abolish the hideous institution of slavery.
People were amazingly pumped up for the war when it started. Things like this roll out of control sometime, and you get really morally up for the war, and you don't see it as fighting for A, B, or C. It's just something that you want to do. And it captured the imagination of people in the North. It also captured the imagination of people in the South. The most interesting statistic that I use when I talk to people is that only about 20% of people who lived in the southern states had any slaves, and less than 4% had more than 100. But what the southern politicians managed to do brilliantly was to convince the 80% of the people who had nothing to do with slavery to fight a war to protect it.
I wonder where their enthusiasm came from. Maybe just the idea that they were being forced to remain in a union that they didn't want.
Forced at the idea of overall states' rights. That while they had nothing to do with slavery, the rest of the rights of states should be theirs and not for the federal government to decide.
Mm-hmm. In your book, Bruce Chadwick, 1858, Abraham Lincoln, Jefferson Davis, Robert E. Lee, Ulysses S. Grant, and the War They Failed to See, I should just say parenthetically, by the way, it's available from Source Books, and you can go to sourcebooks.com. It'll also be on my website as a link, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. The four that you mentioned, and I know you take on a number of different personalities, you don't mention John Brown, the militant anti-slavery abolitionist, and who was involved in armed struggle both in Kansas and then, of course, the famous raid at Harper's Ferry. Did he fail to see a war? I mean, in fact, in many ways, he looked forward to generalized armed conflict against slavery.
There's a chapter about Brown's Christmastime raid in 1858. He had seized a dozen or so slaves in Missouri, and then he and his band of abolitionists had escorted them 1,100 miles to Canada, enduring posses chasing them, large gun battles along the way. But you're right, Brown was convinced that if he could get away with that exodus to Canada, that he could attack Harper's Ferry a year later. And he believed the attack would force all the slaves in the South to rise up and leave the plantations and head north. He truly believed that. I mean, I don't know why, but he did. And then when his revolt did not cause that to happen, he was astonished. The army, Robert E. Lee, goes out and captures Harper's Ferry, arrests Brown, and they hang Brown. And nobody anticipated that Brown's death would make him such an instant martyr And then he would sort of come in many ways to symbolize why a lot of people got into fighting that war.
Yeah, his the mention of him, of course, in the Battle Hymn of the Republic, right? Is that the one?
Yeah, that's right. The song. Yeah. Yeah. John Brown's Body. I think it's called John Brown's Body.
Yeah, right.
It was a poem and a song.
Right. But in fact, it was written...
The melody of the Battle Hymn of the Republic.
Yeah, it was written by the woman who called for the first Mother's Day, too, her name is out of my mind as well. So there's
I can't remember either. He became an instant hero throughout the country, and he was out there, you know, in his thinking. He was just really off the wall.
Well, I was going to say, he certainly in portrayals of him, I mean, there's always, in every portrayal, even the ones that are more positive, John Brown is portrayed as a fanatic in many ways. And that's usually, I guess if he would have, if what he had tried had been successful, he probably would have been an American hero. But in the fact that, it failed, well, think about this. If, say, there would have been a mass slave, either exodus or slave uprising, that would have ended slavery and the Civil War wouldn't have happened. I mean, people, we'd have John Brown's likeness on postage stamps. no doubt. You know?
Well, some people think the way, like Robert E. Lee in the middle of the Civil War when he went up to Gettysburg. Excuse me. He told Jefferson Davis, he said, I'm certain when I march through Maryland and into Pennsylvania, thousands of people in those states will join my army and fight against the Union. He really believed that.
Hmm.
And nobody did that. Not one person joined his army.
Why do you think there was such myopia? Why couldn't people see that a lot of... because it wasn't like in 1858, as you chronicle in your book by that date, for that date. The country was in tremendous turmoil, not only politically, but of course in those areas, in those territories and states that were contending with whether they're going to be slave or free. There was armed conflict at all. It didn't you know, no one imagines now, for instance, there's going to be a civil war between Republicans and Democrats, but it seems a little odd that they did fail to see what was on the horizon.
No, not really. I tell my friends today, I said, if I told you that within 3 years the current problem of illegal immigrants in the U.S. would bring about a civil war in which 630,000 Americans would die, you would laugh at me. That could never happen. No political issue could drive America apart like that, cause all that grief. Never happened. And that's how people thought in 1858. They never thought a civil war would come.
That's an extraordinary figure of death, because I believe in World War II, in both theaters, Europe and the Pacific, I think it's like 450,000. So the fact that in this small nation, 100 years almost before World War II, that's over 600,000 men lost their lives. I mean, that's extraordinary. Absolutely.
Well, the bigger statistic is this. That 630,000 is more than the total of all American lives lost in all the wars this country ever fought.
Hmm. Wow.
At one war.
It didn't seem at the end by 1865, although in many ways there was certainly physical and financial exhaustion, it still didn't seem to quiet the fires, the contention in the South. I mean, what happened after the Civil War, that it was this, you know, the old call, the old cry of the South shall rise again. I mean, it's one of the things that you allude to or even talk about in your book that we interviewed you last about the real Civil War, about the movies. They, in many ways, they lost the battles but won the war.
Yeah, they did. But, you know, Reconstruction was, in one sense, it was a good idea, and it did a lot of good towards integrating the country. But on the other hand, how do you go about that? If you never had a civil war, how do you reconstruct your country? So it was hard to figure out the right things to do or who to have do them. And then the man at the top, of course, with Lincoln's death, is an ineffective leader in Andrew Johnson, who just encountered all these difficulties in reconstruction.
Well, Bruce Chadwick, we have actually about 60 seconds left. 1858-2008, is there lessons to be learned for 2008 from 1858, or is it too broad to really make the generalization?
I think, and this is simplistic, the only lesson, I mean, we study the past because to find out who we are, we need to know who we were. The only lesson is that people should just make more of an effort not to hate each other in America and just to, you know, try and work things out better and compromise than we did in the past.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being our guest again on the Peter Werby Show. The book is fascinating, a look at Abraham Lincoln, Jefferson Davis, Robert E. Lee, Ulysses S. Grant, John Brown, and others in the war they failed to see. The main title of the book is 1858, the author, Bruce Chadwick. The book is published by Sourcebooks. You can go to sourcebooks.com. I'll have a link on my site as well, Peter Werby, that's W-E-R-B-E.com. Thank you for joining me on the Peter Werby Show.
Well, thank you, Peter. This was great.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Are you struggling with too much credit card debt, sky-high interest rates, late fees, over-limit fees, having trouble just making the monthly minimums? We can help. We're Credit Card Relief. We've helped thousands of people become debt-free in months instead of years, all while saving thousands of dollars and without risking your family home. No, this isn't bankruptcy. It isn't one of those credit counseling deals or a high-interest consolidation loan. We're Credit Card Relief. We've been helping people just like you for nearly a decade. We're an attorney-driven program with an outstanding record of performance and client satisfaction. If you're serious about getting out of debt, call Credit Card Relief right now. Don't wait for the collection calls to start. The consultation is free, and the relief is real.
Call 866-290-8282. 866-290-8282. That's 866-290-8282.
Do you want a wireless laptop but your credit score is holding you back? We can help. Guaranteed. If you have a bank account and can afford weekly payments of just $29.99 for 12 months, we'll send you a brand new wireless laptop no matter what your credit looks like. Call Tronix Country now. You're approved for a brand new Dell or HP laptop. Call now and we'll also include a free MP3 player and free LCD TV with your paid order. Call 800-990-2258. Still not sure? Then hear what our customers say.
I'm really enjoying my laptop.
I just wanted to call to say how happy I am with it.
And I'm very pleased with their service, so I would suggest to anyone that is...